You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Best of Flashpoints for the week of January 11th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, scrutinizing Trump, Pelosi, and Schumer on border politics, and why not a cent more should be spent on border security. Also, we speak with constitutional lawyer, political artist, and director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Shahid Buttar. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Thursday's program with author Todd Miller on scrutinizing Trump, Pelosi, and Schumer on border politics and why not a cent more should be spent on border security.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I'm sure you have heard that President Donald Trump has been at the border in Texas, and he's on the stump for the wall that Mexico is not going to pay for. Our next guest has a few problems with the wall and says that not another penny should be spent on it. We are delighted to welcome back, it's been a while, Todd Miller, who has been writing about issues related to the border for many, many years. His latest book, Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security. Todd Miller, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Trump was at the border today. Give us your initial response and thoughts as I'm sure you've been following the story.
Yeah, I mean, Trump, going to the border and, of course, his Oval Office speech a couple nights ago. It all seems, in a lot of ways, to me to be a part of a kind of theatrical presentation around, of course, he wants financing over $5 billion to further expand the border wall. And I say further expand because there already is a border wall on the U.S.-Mexico border that, for whatever reason, seems to not enter the conversation when President Trump, announces his intentions or what he wants to do, nor does it enter the conversation so much even when the Democrats respond to Trump's what Trump is saying that he wants. It's almost incredible how, to me, how a kind of ahistorical narrative gets presented to the public, day after day around these border issues. When, if you look over the last 25 years, we've never had as much. It's been the most massive expansion of the U.S. border apparatus in U.S. history in every single way you can think of it, in terms of agents, in terms of budgets. For example, in 1994, the U.S. Immigration and Border Enforcement budget was about $1.5 billion. And in 2018, if you add together Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, it was $23 billion. So that's a gigantic increase. And that budget for Border and Immigration Enforcement is more than all other law enforcement agencies combined, which is DEA, FBI, U.S. Marshals, all those law enforcement agencies, federal law enforcement agencies combined are less than Border and Immigration Enforcement. So it's been the number one priority for the U.S. government for quite a while. Those sort of massive increases in budgets mean that tons of resources have been put on the U.S. border. Like, there are 650 miles of border of walls and barriers. There's high-tech surveillance technology. technology, cameras that can see 7 miles away, ground sweeping radar systems, forward operating bases, predator be drones. You know, it's the more I list things off, the more it sounds like a typical war zone, and that's how it's been built up over the last 25 years in bipartisan fashion, right? Really, if you really want to look at the expansion, you have to look at the Clinton administration and the operations initiated in the early 1990s. And then you have to look at the post 9/11 era under the George W. Bush administration. And then you have to look at the Obama administration and the record numbers of people deported under his presidency. And then you get to Trump. And by the time Trump takes office in the White House in 2017, he has an arsenal unlike we've ever seen before at his disposal. But then it seems like all that is always erased. And here we are with the Oval Office speech, or here he is at the border today saying acting like there's nothing there, or there hasn't been this incredible emphasis on this border apparatus that it's not only in terms of resources, but in terms of people, of violence against people and people dying because of this apparatus, or families being separated, or people being put in detention, and, you know, people being expelled from the country and banished from the country, deported from the country. And so, yeah, those are, you know, when I see that's the first thing I think of when I, you know, see what I've been seeing the last couple of days.
All right. And we're going to ask you to adjust your body a little bit, Todd Miller, because we're getting a little bit of a broken up sound. We're understanding you, but I want to make sure people can hear what you're saying. You're in Tucson now. Is that correct?
I am in Tucson, Arizona.
No, it's interesting. I was there in 1985 for close to 8 months covering the Tucson sanctuary trial and the emergence of the sanctuary movement at that time as a result to the sort of U.S.-supported wars in El Salvador, Guatemala, what was going on in Honduras in terms of trying to overthrow the Sandinistas. But I remember, because I traveled a lot back and forth between Tucson and the border, you know, it was at that time you could folks could go to a wedding on the Nogales, Mexico side of the border and go to the reception in Arizona. And it sort of reflected the fact that people lived, life went on both sides of the border, but that has now dramatically changed, right?
That is correct. It has dramatically changed. But what you're saying is the essence of the border. Nogales, the people in Nogales refer to it as ambos Nogales, which means the ambos Nogales means that both Nogales, meaning that they're one community, they're not separated. Nogales, Arizona is not separate from Nogales, Sonora, which means there's family ties, community ties, friends, you know, people that, like you say, go to weddings on one side, go to the reception on the other. There used to be, if there's a fire on one side of the border, you know, the fire engines from Mexico would come to the United States, or vice versa. You know, the Cinco de Mayo or the September 16th independence parades would zigzag over the border. And at the time when you were there, there was a fence, it was a chain link fence between the two communities. But that was it, and people would cross pretty freely through holes in that chain link fence. And around 1994, the chain link fence was extracted, a 15 to 20 foot wall, depending where you are, was put in place under what is called Operation Safeguard, which was an operation under the Clinton administration. And that whole idea was to stop all movement across that border in Nogales, in that urban area. And so a big wall went up. Lots of border patrol agents, armed border patrol agents were hired. Technology started to enter. That's when you saw, like, the border patrol getting bigger and bigger budgets. And the idea behind that, really literally separating these two places, was to cut off what was a traditional crossing place for people heading north, and thus creating what they call a funnel effect around the Nogales. So the Arizona desert and the deadly, isolated, dangerous Arizona desert would serve as a deterrent or a blockade of people crossing. And what happened after that was that NAFTA was implemented, of course, in Mexico in 1994, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which caused all kinds of upheavals and more people started migrating out of Mexico than ever before. So they would hit up against this preventive through deterrence policy funnel around this border apparatus. And that's why you had so many people going through the deserts. You still have people going through the deserts and so many deaths of people crossing the border. And to this day, there's about 8,000 corpses of people, the remains that were found in the U.S. borderland since these prevention through deterrence policies were implemented in the early 1990s. And that 8,000 number is probably a low estimate, because there's thousands of families that are looking for lost loved ones. So this is what's dramatically changed over the last 20 years.
I'm thinking about I've even reported in the past on situations where Border Patrol and Homeland Security actually have active searches for the water and the kind of survival things that some groups have chosen to leave in spots where these folks who have been pushed further and further away from the more accessible areas can find water. But actually people are arrested for putting water on the desert for these folks, right?
Yeah. That's true. There's humanitarian aid organizations in Arizona who, and actually across the borderlands, but I'm thinking specifically of the different organizations in Arizona. You know, there's No More Deaths, there's Humane Borders, there's the Samaritans. All these groups go out to the desert and leave water in certain places and put up like camps where you know there's doctors that can help people in distress, that sort of thing, and there was about 3 years ago that No More Deaths, which is one of the organizations, had a camera on one of their cameras. They caught I think it was a wildlife camera, and they got the footage. I'm not clear on how they got the footage, but the footage showed a Border Patrol agent kicking and slicing open water jugs that they had left out in a certain place. And so it showed without a doubt that the Border Patrol was actively destroying humanitarian aid, such as water. And mind you, the death by dehydration is the most common way that people die going through the desert, but that was being destroyed by Border Patrol, while simultaneously volunteers are people working with these humanitarian aid organizations who put out water have been, you know, they've had, you know, they've been arrested for, and if you do it, like, I can think of some cases of humanitarian aid volunteers going to a national park. They go to a national park, they leave water in certain areas, and there's a bunch of national parks right along the border, and they leave water, and then they were arrested by park rangers for littering. So there's been several cases of littering. There's been cases of people in No More Deaths and other organizations driving people from the desert to a hospital, and they've been pulled over by Border Patrol and then charged with, you know, it's smuggling there's pretty intense charges that could be levied against people for anything that resembles smuggling. And there's a recent case that's happening with a volunteer for No More Deaths named Scott Warren, who had been volunteering with No More Deaths in a place called Ajo, Arizona, in the kind of desolate West Desert, in a clinic where people were arriving to the clinic almost on a daily basis. And Border Patrol came in and raided the clinic and arrested Scott Warren. And now he's facing similar charges, and the trial is actually ongoing, so it's going to be, it's a pretty interesting trial to keep an eye on as far as how humanitarian aid is viewed by the U.S. government or how it's going to go through the courts.
Amazing. We're speaking with Todd Miller. His latest book is Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security. I know actually our team, Flashpoint's team, is going to be in Tucson in a couple of weeks. There's going to be a conference, Indigenous communities dealing with, among other things, the impact to, I guess it's called the Tono Ono tribe that lives on both sides of the border and is, among other tribes, is going to be dramatically affected. Could you talk a little bit about more in terms of if they have this massive wall built through these communities, what it's going to be like? I already know it's sort of, one gets the feeling that you can walk out of your house and on the way to go shopping, you stop at a checkpoint and you never come back.
Yeah, that's in some places in Arizona, including the Tono Atsum Nation that you just referred to. The Tono Atsum Nation is a reservation, a Native American reservation that's right on the border. It's the size of the state of Connecticut. So in terms of size, it's the second largest reservation in the U.S. But in terms of it's just a fraction of the Aboriginal land of the Tono Atsum, which ranges deep into Mexico, as far north as Phoenix. And so when the border was drawn in the mid 19th century, without consultation on the Tono Atsum, it went right smack dab through their territory. And now the reservation of the Tono Atsum Nation, as is the case for a lot of places on the border, you cannot leave the reservation without going through a border patrol checkpoint. They're on all paved roads going out. So when you're on the reservation, it's almost as if you are being treated as if you are in another country and you have to go through a border again. And this, as you just mentioned, and a lot of people on the Tono Atsum Nation do go shopping in Tucson, for example, and to go shopping or to go see a doctor or to, you know, do many different mundane things that many of us take for granted, that you don't have to be impeded on the way by the state. They are having to stop at a border patrol checkpoint, and the incidents of being, you know, pulled into secondary, being asked all kinds of questions, being told to get out of your car and having your car searched, or even worse, like people being maced I've interviewed many Tono Atsum people over the years, and there's even talk about being hit with billy clubs and that sort of thing. And so there's all kinds of incidents around the checkpoints. So that's one issue. And the other issue is as you say, like the border itself and the border. Right now in 2006, there was the Secure Fence Act of 2006, and there was no barrier between the Tono Atsum Nation and Mexico, and then after that they built vehicle barriers, and now with the Trump administration, the thought is, well, are they going to take the vehicle barriers out and build a big, you know, wall of some sort? So there's that thought. But it's important to say that the Tono Atsum Nation is already experiencing what almost everyone that I talk to on the nation calls an occupation of the U.S. Border Patrol. It's really difficult to go many places on the Tono Atsum Nation without running into many green-striped Homeland Security vehicles that are constantly patrolling. More and more, like, technologies and cameras are being put up all over the Tono Atsum Nation. Right now, the newest thing is that there's going to be 14 surveillance towers constructed by Elbit Systems, which Elbit Systems is a Israeli company. They got a contract. Elbit Systems of America, a subsidiary, got a contract with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and now are building 53 integrated fixed towers all throughout the border zone in Arizona, and 14 of those are going to go on the Tono Atsum Nation. So there's all this debate and there's some resistance on the nation that I'm sure you'll hear about when you're down there around these surveillance towers and this idea of a virtual wall. And the idea, when you're on the Tonopah Nation, you understand that the border is way more than just the international boundary line, that is treated as a zone, you know, that goes 100 miles inland. And Border Patrol can do, or at least in the current state, can work in almost a state of impunity, where they can run roughshod to whatever it is that they're going to do while on the mission of enforcing the border. And so you get that feeling quite vividly on the Tonopah Nation.
Well, it sounds like occupied Palestine at this point. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Todd Miller. He's based in Houston. He's done some fantastic writing, important writing over the years about issues having to do with the border, U.S. hegemony, and the suffering that goes around misguided and useless policies that have nothing to do with what's really going on the ground and what the needs are of people in this country and the people trying to come into the country. Todd, could you talk a little bit about the sort of the some of the other impacts that this kind of occupation that you've been describing? Of course, it's an environmental nightmare as well, right?
Yeah, it is. Like, for example, the idea of a border wall means a whole, slew of bulldozers coming in and bulldozing land and bulldozing ecosystems and habitats and going through cultural sites as happened on the Tonopah Nation. One really big example is if you look at the Oregon Pipe National Monument and the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, both are located right on the border. And there are about, between the two of them, there's 12,000 miles of wildcat routes. And most of these roads, which shouldn't be there, were made by the Border Patrol. So the Border Patrol really is, going through, literally decimating a national park. And that's just one, example. And you have to imagine that wherever there's agents concentrated along the borderlands, that sort of kind of destruction will be present. The reason why we know about those 12,000 miles is because they were national parks, and people concerned about what was going on in the national parks actually went out and did the research and looked and saw how much destruction there was that was happening. And so, yeah, there's all kinds of, this, destruction, environmental destruction, and the desert ecosystems, they're particularly sensitive and fragile in certain places. Like, there's a certain topsoil that you want to be careful of not ruining. And if you drive the heavy F-150 trucks over them, as has been happening, it's going to really, really damage the ecosystem, not to mention putting up a wall. And again, I want to stress that there is 650 miles of walls and barriers. A lot of them are actual walls. And those walls not only impede people, but impede the flow of wildlife across the border. And so ecosystems are disrupted in that way. And there's, we have plenty of endangered species in this region as well. And so I can go on and on about the environmental consequences, but they are very much there and present.
I think that really helps to explain, and I believe this is the case, that either members of the tribe threaten to or would consider suicide as an act of mercy to call attention to the devastation. Is this, was this a real story?
What I heard is the commissioner of the tribal council on the Tonopah Nation said he used the words "over my dead body." Are they going to build this wall?
I see. I just want the people to get a sense of the intensity of what people are feeling and what's going on here. Because, you know, the idea of walking out of your door and into a checkpoint, it's very hard for people listening to this broadcast to understand.
Right. Yeah, to understand what it is to walk out your door or do anything, like go to the grocery store and have to go through a checkpoint, or go to the grocery store and just be pulled over for whatever reason. And there's a reason why the ACLU calls the border zones and, again, 100-mile jurisdiction, the Constitution-free zone, right? Because the Constitution, the right to be searched, not to be searched nor seized, in the border zone is, you know, at least mangled, if not completely exempted. So you can, if you do leave your house in the Tonantzin Nation, you could be pulled over by the Border Patrol agent. And as people I've interviewed on the Tonantzin Nation, next thing you know, you're pulled out of your truck. Or if you show resistance, like, I don't have to talk to you, or please leave me alone, I'm trying to do my work. If you show my resistance, as one person I interviewed did, he, next thing he knows, he's pulled out of the truck and he's knocked unconscious, and he wakes up, and next thing he knows, he's arrested by the Border Patrol. You know, those sorts of stories are pretty frequent. And one interesting thing from a colleague,
pulled out of his truck, knocked unconscious on the way to what? On the way to his life.
Yeah, he was working. He was going up through the dirt roads and the mountains. He was going home after a long day working on a ranch, I believe. And he was going through the mountains, and all of a sudden a police came face to face with a Border Patrol vehicle, who then, you know, began to pull him over, interrogated him. And when he showed that, when he told them that he did not want to be interrogated and did not want to be stopped, but he just wanted to go home, and to his family and to his wife, that's when, you know, that's when all of a sudden he in that incident, he was actually maced, and then pulled out of his vehicle and then beaten with a billy club.
Wow. All right. Well, we're out of time now, Todd Miller, but we really appreciate the work that you do. We hope to be in touch with you. If you're in Tucson when we get there, we'd love to have you be a part of a couple of our broadcasts. Because obviously this is your beat. We do appreciate, again, the good work. I want to tell people your latest book is Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security. We have even scratch the surface, but thanks for taking the time out. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, and please be in touch when you're in Tucson.
Will do.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints for the week of January 11th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next on the program, we feature an interview from Tuesday's show with constitutional lawyer, political artist Shahid Buttar.
We're delighted to have in the studio somebody who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, both as a political activist, a human rights activist, and somebody who loves music and poetry, and the combination is crucial. You know, sometimes you need that poem or that rap to skip the brain and go right to the heart.
Yes.
And let the sort of the information filter out through the bloodstream. It's a very special way to be informed. I think that it's been at the heart of why I didn't turn out to be a flaming racist like all the people I grew up with. It is good to have you back in the studio. Shahid Buttar, constitutional lawyer, political artist, director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That's a very important operation in the 21st century. And he was the leading challenger to Nancy Pelosi from the left in 2018. And in a moment, we're going to talk about Ms. Pelosi and some of her public appearances post being reelected to be Speaker of the House, if you could call that an election instead of a strong-arming operation. But in about what? In about 35 minutes, the president, Donald Trump, is going to be giving a, I hear it's an 8-minute border speech, and he's going to be repeating some of the garbage that has been spewing out of the White House since he was elected. You are a perfect person to take this on for many reasons. Do you want to talk a little bit about Trump at the wall and the general policy in terms of fear and racist sort of white supremacist mongering that he sort of feeds to his base?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dennis. Sure. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And I should say that I'm speaking for myself, not the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Okay.
But in terms of our...
Although we still love that group.
As we
Go
should.
On.
Yeah. Our kleptocrat in chief lies more or less every time he opens his mouth, and I expect nothing different in that respect this evening. As an immigrant to this country, I do take a great deal of personal offense at the not just the fact that he is willing to disregard any semblance of truth, but particularly the demonization of the people who have been the economic and cultural bedrocks of our country from the beginning. This is a country composed nearly entirely of immigrants. You know, but for the natives against whom we've already, you know, waged a genocide, several genocides for that matter, every person on this continent came from somewhere else. And so the sheer self-defeating aspect of his rhetoric is really disappointing. You know, I often think about how gravely we have betrayed so many of our founding ideals, but particularly the inscription on the Statue of Liberty, you know, this invitation to bring your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. You want to talk about inspiring poetry, right? We have it written in stone. And there is a kleptocrat in Washington who is willing to betray those ideals in order to try to curry favor with his base. And I, setting aside the rhetoric towards immigrants, you asked me to comment on white supremacy. And I think that's one of the lenses through which to see the ultimate import of this administration and the damage it could wreak to the republic. We have seen nothing yet in terms of how badly our civic cohesion could be wrecked should his agenda be allowed to continue unimpeded. And I will say that one of the few areas where I am very enthused by the resistance of the centrist wing of the Democratic Party has been to his foolhardy, reckless, and just silly, quite frankly, and self-serving, which is to say corrupt, claims that we need a wall along the southern border. There's people forget that the net migration across our southern border has been negative for years. And that essentially results from the Obama administration's deportation policies being so aggressive that the United States revealed itself to be an unwelcoming place for immigrants. The people who are rushing the southern border, whose presence is, you know, prompting this current alarm, these are asylum seekers. You know, these are people who are willing basically to throw themselves on the door of a nearby place and say, please take us in. And just to complicate the irony there, they're generally fleeing places that we have destabilized through our own foreign policy, which is to say the claims that the president is making are not only false, they bend truth almost in exactly a way to obscure what the ultimate truth is. And the ultimate truth in this context is that our border policies and our policies towards South America have for decades been corrupt, abusive, disregarding of human rights, inviting precisely the set of affairs that he's now responding to. And I particularly am concerned that in a half hour he might declare emergency powers, that he will be able to do a great many things with that he wouldn't be able to do if still subjected to the congressional oversight and limits that the independent branch of Congress can impose. The invocation of emergency powers will be a dangerous threat to the republic separate from entirely the border issue, because the accretion of executive power is one of our constitutional crises that's been continuing now for decades. And the invocation of emergency powers, particularly to find his way around a partisan logjam to create a self-serving infrastructure project that serves no purpose in terms of national security, but just to look fast forward, if the dystopia creeps and grows much, much worse, I could anticipate a potential future where that wall, like most, is not there to keep anyone else out, but rather to keep Americans in. And I'm shocked at having heard, quite frankly, no one say that on the national stage. This is about as anti-liberty, authoritarian a policy as one could imagine. And I think that all Americans should be up in arms and very concerned at the moment to prevent this from proceeding.
I think one could think of that southern border as a barometer of the failure of U.S. policy down south, war and free trade policies. It's a policy that obviously has led, on the one hand, to forced migration. It's sort of a hammer and anvil. So they're forced out of their countries, and now Trump is going to be at the border with the military slamming the hammer down as they arrive, and we've already seen that.
That's right. And it's also another of the policies that's really driving the migration crisis is our foreign policy and drug policy. Our militarization not only of the southern border of the United States, but frankly most of Latin America. Right. I mean, the history of our nation's serial military interventions into other countries, Latin America looms especially large in that list. And the fact that we have done more or less everything we can to undermine democracy in the countries that are most closely neighbor us is to your point, you know, a predictable vector driving these kinds of migrations. There's also a piece here to recognize in which the way that the rights of Americans are impacted. So by militarizing the border, by creating interior to the country's surveillance programs that track people and attempt to, for instance, I mean, I can think of a program called the Next Generation Initiative, which was under the Obama administration presented to the public as an immigration deportation facilitation scheme. And it was supposed to be a biometric identification program tracking only people suspected of criminal activity to basically facilitate their deportation. And what ended up getting built was a biometric database with over 400 million records in it.
Wow.
You know, co-opting driver's license photos from state DMVs and whatnot.
Right.
You might think of those as externalities, which is to say that the things that happen not within the four corners of how it's presented publicly. But in any attempt to restrict immigration, we will necessarily undermine the rights of Americans. And that's particularly when we're talking about asylees. Like these aren't even labor migrants. These are people just fleeing violence.
Yes.
In their home countries. And if those are people to whom we are unwilling to open our arms, I dare say that the nation that I came to as a young immigrant in 1976 really has turned entirely on its head.
Where did you come from?
So I was born in England to a family in the Pakistani South Asian diaspora, and we settled in a small town in rural Missouri where we were welcomed with open arms. And even in that particular place, I suspect in the current time slice, someone, you know, with my color skin, with the exact same story, might be treated very differently. And I think that reflects a profound failure, both of our political culture, but ultimately our civic culture. And this is one of the areas where I think the attitudes of leaders and how they present their concerns are especially important. It's not just the president who's dog whistling and fomenting racial animus and strife and white supremacy. It's also the sustained failure of the people opposing our president and the people in other sectors to meaningfully address the roots of these crises, right? Nobody talks about immigration through the lens of our failed foreign policy and military interventions and drug policy. That just doesn't happen. That's not what you hear about. Nobody talks about the CIA running crack in the U.S. cities to start a drug war in order to foment its own rogue foreign policy in the South. Like, these are crucial parts of the history that most Americans just don't even know, which is appalling to me.
And in part, we have to blame the corporate press
hugely
on that, because that's where we're lost in terms of critical thinking and historical context. But back to Trump for a moment.
Yeah.
I do see this now as a form of ethnic cleansing. I do see there is clearly a group of white power brokers who understand that the future is going to be quite different and quite a bit of a different color than what's going on now. And so I see this this struggle and this last gasp as trying to hold on to that, but I don't think they can.
I think you're right to describe their aims. And I do think that...
Not the last gasp.
Well, that was where we were going. I mean, the question is, is the United States of America and the civic culture that remains of it strong enough to resist this latest onslaught and attack on our fundamental principles? And I do have a great deal of faith in the American people. I have a great deal less faith in our leaders of all stripes. And I would put it this way. I think that the white supremacists recognize that their days are numbered, and they are basically, you know, waging a rearguard action to do everything they can to preserve their future power. When you describe the vilification of immigrants as ethnic cleansing, I have a hard time with that, only because ethnic cleansing is genocide, of course. And as much as the effort to close the border or vilify people might shift the racial composition of this country, it at least mercifully spares them the ignominy of having to survive here. Though when you talk about people fleeing violence in their own countries, it begs the question, where do you go? And that's exactly, I think, the question that people who support the president aren't asking themselves of the people who are throwing themselves at our shores and at our borders, pleading for help and refuge. And where else would you want to see them go? And I think that's a question that nobody asks, that all of us should grapple with.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Shahid Bhutara. He is a constitutional lawyer, political artist, director of grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And he was the leading challenger to Nancy Pelosi from the left in 2018. And I'm going to ask you about what Nancy Pelosi said. But first, let's hear a little bit of, I'm not sure which one we got queued up, but we got something of yours here that we would like to play. We'll take a short break. Here we go.
Kids slouch on a couch and vouch for this and that. Dude, you gotta see this music video stat. Then they all roll up to the shopping mall, scoping clothes that happen to be in fashion that fall. The gall appalls me. Why should we all be passive recipients of rules we use to test what we deem as deviant, what we treat with lenience, or what we shower praise? How we spend our days, our cultural mores, our norms, our styles, whether we wear berets, smoking all the while, and how we see the destinies of our societies. What we believe defines us as humanity. These things are key to both you and me. So why don't we all decide what they're gonna be? Turn off the TV. Really? Try writing some poetry, maybe, instead of 7 to 10 every weeknight spent in front of the TV, watching our minds get bent. So many things to see. What will it be? We watch reality rather than TV. I might as well be hitting my head with a brick. Our culture's consumerism's two-century stick. We're all part of it. Just try to rise above it. You might love it. Say, take this job and shove it. Or this scene, or this team. I mean, whatever and all things that inhibit your dreams. It only seems that we need to resign our teens. There are plenty of means, from eating more ice cream to changing the facets of life on which our psyche leans. It could be fame, could be money, sex, power, could be getting your soul prepared for the final hour. But the prognosis is dour until we take control of our cultural choices. Don't resign your voices. It's a matter of communication that requires that we build ourselves a global nation. Everyone knows that to maintain a conversation, you've got to speak your mind. Talking liberation, freedom from the conflagration of our cultures. Consider it fertilizer or mulch. You got to raise your voice to make a choice. Defense appropriations and money for education. Which do you think will make this a stronger nation? 7 to 10 every week nights spent in front of the TV, watching our minds get bent. There are so many things to see. What will it be? We watch reality rather than TV. Will we address our problems or continue being goblins? Our willful ignorance destroying the planet slowly, leaving wills to a world we've left unholy by our apathy, our audacity. Our epitaph will be a 21-gun salute to good riddance. Everything we gained in our glory is a pittance, and on this culture we've constructed, I spit in derision. Our leaders have no vision, leaving it up to you and me to steer these cultures that we see hurtling toward obvious oblivion, callous disregard for this world we're living in. 7 to 10 every weeknight spent in front of the TV, watching our minds get bent. So many things to see, what will it be? We watch reality rather than TV. We watch reality rather than TV. I said we watch reality rather than TV. 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 I said we watch reality rather than TV. 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 We watch reality.
That's Shahid Buttar. He's my guest. He's also a constitutional lawyer, a political artist, as you can hear, director of grassroots advocacy at Electronic Frontier Foundation. He is not appearing for them in this context, although we love that organization. And he did challenge Nancy Pelosi from the left in 2018. And it was a strong challenge, and she deserved to be challenged. Did you hear Nancy Pelosi when she was asked if she supports Black Lives Matter? Her response sort of sounded like a member of the a Trump administration.
Yeah, it was disappointing.
All lives matter, she said. And she never answered that question.
Yeah. This is not a time in our nation's history for people to lie or try to obscure what they believe, right? And at the end of the day, as a constitutional lawyer and an immigrant and a person of color, I think that the crisis of police violence and accountability is one of the most pressing issues facing our country. We can't claim meaningfully to care about human rights when unarmed people die at the hands of police on the order of one a day. Yeah. It's particularly shocking because we don't even know how many people die at the hands of police who are unarmed. No one keeps those statistics. We have to turn to British newspapers for that. And I think that going to your point about the corporate press and how much it does us a disservice. I have another rhyme that is called Ferguson to Jerusalem, and it starts out, there's a Mike Brown in every town. And that's the unfortunate reality now, is if you were to say their names, as we are called to do in the movement, I could go on the rest of our broadcast just saying the names of people who have been killed by police. And to have a federal representative from a country that prides itself on being the most progressive city in the country not to squarely embrace a criminal justice reform agenda that would include, for instance, rescinding the qualified immunity doctrine so that litigants could prove guilt of officers without having to prove their intent to harm their civil rights. Radical criminal justice reform to, for instance, finally adopt the End Racial Profiling Act. I've been fighting for that bill to be passed by Congress for over 15 years now, including years when Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker of the House and, you know, refused to move that bill forward. The criminal justice system, what I actually describe as a criminal injustice system, you know, the phenomenon of mass incarceration and the creation of a racial caste system.
And that is not just rhetoric.
This is well documented.
Serial injustice.
There's no question. And anybody who might be alarmed by some of these concerns, you know, I particularly refer to Michelle Alexander's work and the new Jim Crow. But, you know, among the things she particularly points out is that the continuation of slavery into the 21st century through our penal system is it is a horror in plain sight, and it is not one that we can lay at President Trump's feet. It is one in which our entire political culture and system has been thoroughly complicit. And I think that, unfortunately, the speaker's response to the question revealed that. And it revealed how desperately we need people in this country who actually understand our fundamental principles and are willing to fight for them to wield these seats of influence and be casting votes on what will the policies be of tomorrow if we are so rightfully disgusted at those of the past.
And I assume these are the kinds of things that drive you to want to run for office.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure you were going to get there.
I don't know necessarily. I mean, I quite honestly would prefer to just live my life, but yeah. I feel to some extent conscripted by current events. I'm a DJ and a music producer, and I like to write. You know, my idea of a good time is not necessarily to run around shilling for myself, but frankly, that's what we need, is somebody with at least modicum of principle and a sense of the history and a willingness to go to bat for them. And the one thing I do have is a great deal of conviction. And I recognize the importance of that at this particular time. And the discreet reason that I ran in 2018 was because Representative Pelosi undermined a proposed surveillance reform that I'd spent a lot of time working on and most of my career. And I've seen the co-optation of congressional Democrats by the national security industries and, you know, precisely the set of actors that Eisenhower warned us about, that Obama talked about on the campaign trail and then ultimately became co-opted by himself. And I cannot bear to watch the country that my family moved to be free fall under the yoke of authoritarianism. I'm not willing to let that happen on my watch. You know, I would rather throw myself on the rails, and that's kind of what I've done politically. In 2018, those were among the issues, that criminal justice reform, Medicare for all, among the issues that we particularly talked about. And going forward in 2020, those issues, as well as the Green New Deal, rationalizing military spending to address our society's needs rather than just the interests of federal defense contractors. Those are some of the other issues we'll be talking a lot about over the next 2 years, and I hope very much to see some progress on those issues from the Congress as it's currently composed. And a lot of that will be determined very much by Pelosi's stomach for change and her willingness to embrace the needs of the future as opposed to holding the line on the paradigm that she's spent her whole career defending.
And Christina, please join us from Petaluma, California. Christine.
Hello there.
Hi.
Thank you for such a thoughtful dialogue to begin with. And my question is regarding the potential executive order, assuming that Trump did decide that he was going to issue an executive order. What legal options are there for Congress or anyone else, for that matter, to challenge that?
Not many. They exist, and I do expect a legal challenge should the president attempt to invoke emergency powers this evening. The challenge is that the Constitution reserves a great deal of influence to the executive branch, and the Bush administration was infamous for relying on that authority to extend its reach into different policy areas. The discrete danger of an emergency power declaration will be that the president will be able to rechannel the Defense Department's funds away from whatever those funds had been appropriated for and spend them instead on a wall. There are other issues, though, that happen here, because when you declare emergency powers, there's no necessary limit to what those powers might be, right? I mean, the very same invocations could be used to deny civil liberties, which, of course, are implicated by a border wall. Will the damage to civil liberties be limited in that context? I am not so sure at all. So there will be legal challenges that emerge in the various discrete contexts that emergency powers threaten rights. A facial challenge to the invocation itself, I don't have a great deal of hope for, largely, you know, not only because the Constitution does empower the executive branch within its sphere of influence, but also, quite frankly, I don't have a great deal of faith in our courts. Because if our courts did their job, we wouldn't be in this mess, right? I was in law school when the Bush versus Gore decision happened, and I don't think the Supreme Court has been legitimately composed since then. And that's another issue that people don't talk about. And implementing through congressional legislation 18-year staggered terms for Supreme Court justices to recover the independence of the judiciary and depoliticize the Supreme Court would need to happen for us to have any faith in the judiciary in its capacity institutionally to do its job and perform its constitutional function. Ultimately, the resistance to a potential declaration of emergency powers will have to be political, and we can't rely on the court system to save us. I would say that more broadly also with respect to Mueller's investigation. There's a great deal of hope and reliance on legal processes, and there have been instances in our nation's history where we have gained rights through a legal process. The vast majority of our most treasured rights were won politically, and if there were legal victories, they came in the wake of the political victory. Marriage equality, we got through a political victory that compelled a legal victory. I mean, there are exceptions, Brown versus Board and racial equality. That was an area where the court did get in front, but that has been vastly the exception to the rule. And if there was any way to, like, boil that down, I would just say the response to the president's forthcoming statement must come from each of us. We cannot defer to judges or our elected representatives the responses that we must each make. And I'd also say two words to end that: general strike, and I will leave it at that.
General strike. Ariane, why don't you join us from San Francisco? Welcome.
Yes, the question is, how bad does it have to get before people turn off their iPhones, turn off their Facebook and take some responsibility. Our government is pillaging and bombing and raping the planet, and our corporations do likewise. And we talk about it, but what are we individually doing and as a group to make this different? And it's not on an individual level only. It has to be in larger groups and with the ability and willingness to sacrifice both time and energy and perhaps money, but even perhaps one's life. This is what we're up against, because the planet itself and humanity is at stake. We're living on the lip of extinction.
Wow. Speak it, sister. Particularly the point about individual action connecting to groups. As you said that, you know, I was pumping my fist in the air, in that it is absolutely crucial that each of us who are concerned about the way our country is careening take individual action. This is to say, think globally and act locally. And, you know, but I said very flippantly at the end of my last comment, a general strike. The way to get there, the way to mount effective resistance always is to organize. And I do think that there is a trap to some extent. You know, I spend a lot of my time defending technology and users who use it. And I think the technology, particularly in the social media arena, has been very beguiling. And ultimately, while empowering in some arenas, you know, the Movement for Black Lives, for instance, has relied on it very crucially. Social media can be a dramatic and vast distraction to the more crucial project of meeting your neighbors, connecting with them, sharing your concerns, understanding where they intersect, making a plan for how to advance your shared interests together, and then executing those plans. That's what organizing is. And it is a lost art, but it is one that we desperately, desperately need. And, you know, if you're listening to this broadcast and you're concerned about what is happening, find your neighbors and have that conversation. Discover where your interests intersect and make a plan about what you will do within your reach to address those concerns. Just as an example, I'm part of Democratic Socialists of America. And in San Francisco, when the wildfires happened last fall, we didn't just sit around on social media saying, why isn't the city handing out masks? We didn't just lobby a government to take care of our neighbors. We took direct action in solidarity with people who didn't have masks. It's not even that complicated. It is the simple application of action to thought. It is the praxis beyond critique that we need so desperately. And, you know, having been a direct action organizer and, you know, a policy advocate in Washington and a nonprofit leader and an impact litigator and all these different things, I recognize the crucial function that lay people have to play here. And if we are ever going to get to the point of being able to execute a general strike, which is the strongest lever that we have as a people to compel the respect from our government that we have been guaranteed in writing and denied, we are going to have to organize. And that is to say, getting beyond, with all due respect, the flashpoints, to dig beyond the news cycles and to suss out where your interests and those of your neighbors intersect, and what are the things that you can do, whether it's serving your neighbors, whether it's mounting lobbying operations, whether it's doing something on social media. There are a million opportunities available to all of us, and this is a time when all of us need to be doing something.
All right. It has been a pleasure having you here. We have 1 minute left. There's a couple of things that you're engaged with, involved with, recommendations for people who want to get involved. Go.
Sure. We'll be running in 2020. People can visit us online at shahidforchange.us. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much. Keep up the great work, brother.
Beautiful. We thank you for your presence. And for if people want to hear your raps, where do they go to
find
that?
You can find, I've got plenty of music on Mixcloud and SoundCloud, shahidbuchar.com. I've been counseled to share more poetry in the context of the campaign, so I'll look forward to doing that as well.
Does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
To New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, why we need to declutter and why it's so hard to do. We'll hear from Lloyd Alter, Erica Lane, Chumbawamba, and myself. I hope you'll stay tuned. This past week, I've been rounding up and attending to most of my pocket knives. I'm still not sure exactly how many pocket knives I own, 15 or more likely 20. That's quite a hefty number. That's 5 or 6 times as many as I actually need, seeing as I don't live in Arkansas, don't whittle, never need to cut a plug of chawing tobacco, and don't have to trim any animals' hooves. I made a big pile of pocket knives and gave most of them a good oiling and a halfway decent sharpening. In truth, what most of them needed was a good throwing out. No can do, of course, to throw out a conceivably useful tool just because it's useless is beyond my ability. Even a poorly made tool with a blade that wiggles from side to side and cost me maybe $5 20 years ago. Sorting through this big pile of stuff, I realized that I didn't know the basic vocabulary of pocket knives, so I couldn't see what I was looking at. A couple of hours on the internet got me halfway up to speed. So now, when I look at a knife, I can see that the blade is a clip point, or a drop point, or, theoretically, a straight back. I don't actually own any of them. Now that I know the vocabulary, I can tell a spey blade from a sheep's foot, from a Warncliffe blade. I can recognize some standard knife models, too. A trapper, a stockman, a doctor's knife. I even have a doctor's knife, a gift from my grandfather. He was a pharmacist, not a doctor, but close enough. It is a drop-point jackknife with one long, thin blade, polished mirror-bright, and a long, thin spatula. The bottom of the handle is a flat rectangle of brass, good for crushing tablets. This doctor's knife was well made in the USA long ago by the Utica Cutlery Company. The scales on the handle side are fake mother of pearl. On one of them is stamped mentholatum. It's a promotional item from a patent medicine company. The practical value to me of a doctor's knife is close to zero. But who could part with such a lovely old relic? Not I. Through working and cleaning and oiling my big pile of pocket knives, I came to appreciate how good my two good knives are. With their silky smooth action, rock-solid lockup, beautiful balance, and good single blade. Each is American-made and 20 years old. A buck and a case. Those are the companies that made them. I could get along fine with just either one of them, plus one or two miniature folders and the medium-sized Swiss Army knife in my bicycle bag. So I could get along fine with 3 folding pocket knives. add my grandfather's knife for sentimental value, that makes 4 pocket knives I need and 15 clutter. Clutter I can't bring myself to part with. Doctor, I need help, and I'm afraid mentholatum won't do the trick. Then there's books. My wife and I are both avid readers. Books keep joining our household as purchases or Christmas presents. We have long since filled every bookshelf in our house. At the moment, we have maybe 75 more books than we have space for. We should give half of our books away, or throw them away. No, I could no more discard a book than I could discard a child or a pocket knife. I still regret getting rid of my college geology textbook. Once I wanted to look up something in it and couldn't. I won't go on, but with pocket knives and books, I've just scratched the surface of the clutter in my life. Centuries back, England had her Boxing Day, December 26. Here's what I understand of this foreign holiday. The stores were all closed that day by law. Servants, many of whom had to work on Christmas, had the day off. On Boxing Day, people would box up all sorts of clothing and merchandise they didn't need and give it away to the servants and other poor people. Everybody came out ahead. Now, though, I'm told that on Boxing Day, stores in England are all open and jammed with shoppers seeking post-Christmas price markdowns. The British version of our Black Friday, which now seems to include all Thanksgiving Day as well. Bah, humbug! My favorite anarcho-syndicalist rock band, Chumbawamba, had a nifty song called Buy Nothing Day. Sounds like a tradition worth starting here, or for the Brits, going back to.
I woke up this morning, my temperature high.
Bye, bye, bye.
I'll never buy nothing again, I lied.
Bye, bye, bye.
My doctor, he told me to stay out of town.
Bye, bye, bye.
He said, affluenza will get you down.
Bye, bye, bye.
What did you do in the war, Dad? What did you do in the war? Ring up the tills in the high street, I'm not coming in anymore.
There's a price tag on me and the sick on the floor. We're buying up anything we can't afford. Wherever I go, I keep hearing this voice saying, choose what you want, but there's so little choice.
What did you do in the war, Dad? What did you do in the war? Bring up the tills in the high street, I'm not coming in anymore.
Give it a rest. There's dumb moves behind me and back that's above. I pawned my affections and still got no love. My heart and my pocket will say it's unfair. I'm unlearning the cost of this laissez-faire. What did you do in the war, Dad? What did you do in the war? Ring up the tills in the high street, I'm not coming in anymore. What did you do in the war, Dad? What did you do in the war? Ring up the tills in the high street, I'm not coming in anymore.
November 23 is Buy Nothing Day.
I came across an interesting blog post about clutter. I'm actually not crazy about the tone of the piece. It's a bit of a self-help pep talk, apparently addressed especially to bourgeois women. And I'm not crazy about the limited perspective here. Only one small bit about global economic implications, and nothing at all is said about ecology or the environment or all the hydrocarbons involved in making, shipping, and then maybe incinerating all that stuff. No, the post is mostly about personal psychology. So I'll be the first to say the perspective is limited. Even so, reading the piece, I found myself saying, yes, she's right, and yes, that's just how I felt. The author is Jessica Lane. Her piece is titled, 9 Hard Truths About Clutter You Need to Hear. I have condensed it slightly for radio. Here goes. Clutter is keeping too many of us from living well. Let's change that. 9 Hard Truths About Clutter You Need to Hear. 1. Nothing you own is ever really gone. It will continue to exist somewhere. I remember searching for a piano on Craigslist. It turns out there are pianos all over the place. Old pianos in people's back rooms, sheds, even their gardens. Discovering this motivates me to be judicious about what I buy. 2. The best way to clear clutter is to reduce what you bring in. Never start a decluttering journey without giving real thought to your consumption habits. Otherwise, you'll find yourself back in the same spot, overcluttered and weighed down. Set a goal to not only get rid of more, but to buy less. 3. Are you shopping to escape your feelings? Most of us have unhealthy ways of hiding from our feelings. We eat, drink, watch TV, or shop so that we don't have to feel our truth in a given moment. We crave the dopamine hit we get from eating something sweet or buying something. Masking our feelings sounds so much more appealing than sitting with them. But real freedom comes when we begin to practice experiencing our humanness rather than running from it. Shop less, allow yourself to feel your feelings, and live with less clutter. 4. There is a dark side to donating. If the above weren't reason enough to limit your consumption, how about this? Here are 2 quotes from recent articles. By one estimate, used clothing is now the United States' #1 export by volume, with the overwhelming majority sent to sub-Saharan Africa. African textile industries are closing their factories and laying people off because they cannot make clothes as cheaply as those American items found in the bend-over markets. Continuing with Erica Lane's 9 Hard Truths You Need to Hear About Clutter, 5. Everything you own is something you have to take care of. A friend recently told me what started her on a path to minimalism. She read a single paragraph where the author said that every decorative item sitting on a table is nothing more than something you have to dust. She realized in that moment that everything you own is something you have to take care of. She cleared off most of the surfaces of her house and instantly felt like she could breathe. Number 6. Clutter has been linked to depression. Women in particular suffer under the weight of our family's belongings. UCLA researchers found a correlation between high cortisol levels, read stress, in women and a high density of household objects. Clutter accounts for a significant unseen portion of your mental load. 7. The longer you keep something, the more attached you become. One by one, as my sisters and I approached adulthood, our parents gave each of us a cedar hope chest, a place to store sentimental items. I remember my older sister jokingly warning me to be careful about what I put in there, because if it's there long enough, it starts to feel special no matter what it was. It turns out she was right. I now have a stack of random papers and letters from my high school days. They didn't feel particularly significant at the time, but now that I've had them for 15 years, they feel hard to part with. So, consider yourself warned. 8. Eventually, someone will have to decide what to do with every item you own. Whether it's you or one of your loved ones, every non-consumable item will eventually be handled, sorted, and kept, sold, or donated. Everything you buy increases this burden on yourself, and someday the burden on your survivors. Is that what you really want? Less is more. Number 9. Your stuff is getting in the way of the best stuff. The author continues, I find this one the most compelling, and also the most hopeful. Imagine what it would feel like to walk into your home and be greeted by belongings you love, and nothing more. Imagine what you could do differently with your time if you're spending only a fraction of it managing your stuff. Imagine yelling at your kids a lot less because they have half as many toys cluttering up your living space. It feels good to imagine, right? I promise, it feels even better to live it. Okay. Thanks to Erica Lane for 9 hard truths about clutter you need to hear. That's from her blog, ericalane.co. That's spelled L-A-Y-N-E, ericalane.co. I am speaking these words at WWUH's East of the River Satellite Studio and Skunk Works, near my desk. The large desktop has maybe 1 square foot of unused space left. Total. Everything else is clutter. It will probably take me at least an hour to clear the desktop down to its essentials, which are 1 laptop computer and a can of ballpoint pens. Clearing off the clutter will take at least an hour, because I will first have to find a place to put each of the 30 or so random objects that shouldn't be on my desk, but are. There's no good place for most of them anywhere else either. This desktop clutter doesn't even include my 20 folding blade pocket knives, most of which are tucked away in the desk drawer. If I were to join the Navy, remind me to stay out of the submarine service. Not nearly enough space on board for my essentials. Maybe the French Foreign Legion would work. The Sahara seems to have plenty of room. Jessica Lane is right. Even if you want to get rid of a lot of your stuff, Sorting through it all for disposal is a burden just as big as keeping it all. But let's move from the personal to the public. One of Erica Lane's very good points is that there's no mere technical fix to the problem. We have to change our behavior and our mindset. That's especially true in our public clutter. For example, single-use containers made of recyclable materials is not a good answer to anything. First, there's too much energy needed for the whole process. And second, because many seeming recyclables can't actually be recycled. Replacing disposable styrofoam cups with disposable paper cups is not the answer. We have to change our mindset and our behavior. Here is environmentalist Lloyd Alter in conversation with Alex Wise.
Well, the single biggest problem that we've got is the disposable cup, because the disposable cup is mostly non-recyclable. They're lined with a plastic so they don't get soggy and leak. If the plastic lid is attached to the paper cup, then somebody's got to actually separate them. They can recycle the lid, but not the cup. This uses a lot of energy and a lot of water to make the paper. And the plastic lids are another one of those sources of plastics that are getting into the ocean and are causing all the problems we have. And the liners probably are disintegrating and becoming a microplastic. Fundamentally, plastics are a huge problem in so many ways, from A, the fact that they're made from petrochemicals, and B, that they're all ending up in our babies, in our animals, in our fish, and in our water. So this is the main thing. Now, a lot of companies are trying to figure out this sort of circular economy way. You know, how do we take the cup back? How do we, some are putting chips in the bottom of plastic cups so you can take it and they can recover the cup. And it's all crazy. You know, we perfectly knew how to have a cup of coffee 50 years ago. You went to the coffee shop, you sat down, you drank it out of a China mug. And this is what we have to, I think, we have to change our coffee culture, not just our cup. And we have to stop thinking that we have to walk down the street with a paper cup, but in fact that we should sit down and enjoy it, which is what Schultz, when he founded Starbucks, thought it would be, the third place where you'd go and actually have a cup of coffee.
Wow, that's a radical idea that I hadn't really thought of. I do remember my grandfather around 15 years ago, who was already in his late 80s, remarking at these people who had walked by, some with coffee cups and some with their water bottles. And he was like, when did everybody get so effing thirsty? I just thought that was like, you have to constantly be hydrating while you're walking. But the idea of actually drinking a cup of coffee while you're not on the move is a pretty revolutionary one, I guess.
Well, and the water thing, you know, he was absolutely right. We've been totally sold a bill of good about this constant need to be hydrated and carried bottled water everywhere. And again, for years we've been complaining about bottled water because of the water, and this is so stupid. Water's almost free, and it's perfectly safe, and it's perfectly good in most municipal water systems, probably better than the bottled water. And the point now that I keep stressing over and over again, it's the plastics. It's the single biggest single-use plastic product. And to make that, you've got to have natural gas. And this is, according to the GASC, the producers, 30% of all the oil and natural gas in 15 years, as more people drive electric cars, as much as 30% of all the fossil fuels are going to be going into plastics. And most of those go into single use. So this is what we have to stop with the constant hydration. The disposable bottles have to go, and the disposable cups have to go. And we have to sort of change our culture a little bit to adapt to that, rather than everybody carrying around a mug so that they can walk with a mug instead of a paper cup. Slow down, sit down, smell the coffee, and enjoy it.
Wake up and smell the coffee, indeed, as Dear Abby used to say. Or was it Ann Landers? In any case, it's good advice. And here's some more from Chumbawamba.
Hey, wake up. Enough is enough, is enough, is enough. Open your eyes, time to wake up. Enough is enough, is enough, is enough.
Thanks to Sea Change Radio for the interview with Lloyd Alter, and thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. On the web, we are at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, urging illegitimi non carborundum, advising maybe you're not crazy, maybe the system is, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. With the elections coming up next week, today you'll hear an interview with Green Party candidate for Secretary of State, Mike DeRosa. Mike DeRosa, welcome to the show.
Cheryl, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to speak out.
Yes. One of the things I always appreciate about the Green Party is their stance on 9/11. But maybe you could tell us, what is their position on 9/11?
Well, Green Party wants a new investigation because we believe that 9/11 is a classic casus belli, which is Latin for an act or event that provokes war or is used to justify war. And I think that this is a classic example of this type of situation where this event was used to get us involved in the Middle East and, quite frankly, into endless war.
And not to mention taking away our civil liberties. And I understand that Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, got into a lot of trouble when she put out that letter calling for a new investigation.
Yes. I mean, I think that this is a taboo subject that no one is allowed to say or speak about. And it's too dangerous to ask these questions. And they hide it behind a linguistic trick, which is that essentially this is a conspiracy theory. I would argue that what we have here is a coincidence theory. All of these things that happened on 9/11 are a huge coincidence. All elements of our government failed us. Now, maybe that's true and maybe it isn't. I don't know. But I think we have a right to ask a serious question about a serious problem that we have with the theory behind what actually happened on that day. And unfortunately, it is politically impossible to bring this up and to discuss it in a rational and intelligent way.
Yeah, and I think one has to ask oneself, why? Why wouldn't people want to investigate this more and know more about what happened? So,
because 9/11 is the linchpin for all of these wars.
Right.
Just like the sinking of the Maine in the Spanish-American War,
right,
or the sinking of the Lusitania for World War I, or Pearl Harbor during the Second World War. And in that case, it was just creating a situation in which, you know, the Japanese might attack us, just setting bait. But here it's much deeper. And I believe that we see this in the Vietnam War. You know, what do we know now about the Gulf of Tonkin? We know that it was a total phony event. So all of these things, and quite frankly, like one CIA agent said, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin is like a trolley car. One comes along every 15 minutes. So if it hadn't been then, it would have been later.
Yeah.
So presidents want to create wars. They need a justification to sell these to the American people. And it's not just America. It's all countries of the world. They all engage in this sort of deception.
Right. The false flag events like this are very common to get what governments want. So, Mike, you're running for Secretary of State on the Green Party against the Democratic incumbent Denise Merrill. There's a Republican, Susan Chapman, and a Libertarian Party candidate, Heather Quinn.
That's correct.
So tell me, what is the responsibility of the Secretary of State?
Well, there are two major focuses for the Secretary of State. The one is dealing with and controlling, for the most part, elections. Obviously, elections are taken care of on the local level, but the Secretary of State has great power and great ability to have oversight and constitutionally has oversight over elections. The other is the creation of charters, also known as LLCs, limited liability corporations or incorporations. These are very important powers. And the problem, as I see it, with Denise Merrill is a very nice person. I respect her, but I also respectfully disagree with her politicizing this office. She's turned it into an outlet, essentially, that is an extension of the Democratic Party. And I could go into detail, but it would take two programs to do it. But I can show you evidence of that. And over again, I feel that this is incorrect, and I feel that it needs to be changed. If I were to become the Secretary of State, I would not politicize the office. What I would do is be the Secretary of State for everyone.
And why are you running? Why do you want to be the Secretary of State for everyone?
Because I see some inherent problems in our elections. And let me start off by simply saying that one of the big issues during this campaign, especially with Denise Merrill, our present Secretary of State, is she's raising questions about security. While it was the Green Party, and me in particular, and other people who created this organization called Voter Opportunity Through Election Reform. And we were able in two sessions of the legislature to pass a voter verifiable paper trail system. Now, how did this happen? I was very concerned after the Florida debacle in 2000 that our elections were being stolen. So I did some research and I contacted a very important person in the election field Her name is Rebecca Mercury. She runs a outfit called Notable Software, and she's an expert in the issue of election machines. She wrote her PhD thesis about it. She published an article which was very similar to her PhD thesis called A Better Ballot Box. So I invited her on my program here to speak, and then I got her in front of the legislature to speak about the anomalies that, you know, not necessarily even political anomalies, where candidates were elected because they received the votes of their opponent. And this was not simply a political issue, it was a technological snafu. So we found that most people in the legislature agreed with this idea of going down the road of her system, which she invented, which is the voter verifiable paper system, sort of like an SAT test. You fill in the little bubbles, and then you feed it into a scanner. The breakdown in this system is in the audit after the election. We made a big deal about the audit when we passed the law. And I talked to Rebecca Mercury about 8 months ago, and I said, do you think a 5% audit, which is what they reduced it to, both the legislature and I guess the Secretary of State went along with it. I don't know all the details, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that we have to have a statistically significant audit, and 5 or 10% is not it. So if I were to become the Secretary of State, I would craft legislation and bring experts to Connecticut to tell us how to make sure that our elections are free, transparent, open, and correct.
Yes. And speaking about election fraud, basically is what you're alluding to there. What are some of the ways that elections can be skewed, or how does fraud take place?
Well, it's the interface between procedural democracy and technology. And that's where I'm at. That's that point of contact, because they're using technology in ways that are detrimental to free and open elections. And what they're doing is they're using touchscreen modules, which are essentially voting into a black box. And Rebecca Mercury and many other people have written numerous articles, which, of course, you never read about because they're too dangerous for you to hear or read or see. But the issue is that what you have here is no record. There's no physical record. Not that you're supposed to know how you voted. It's simply there's no physical record of your vote that you can tally after the election. So we have made great strides here. When we passed this law back in 2005, we made a big leap towards saving our state from the kind of problems that they have in Ohio and Florida and Arizona and so forth, which continue to go on. And these businesses are preying off of the industry. And they're also, and I think the reduction in the number of people who vote is related to the fact that many people distrust inherently elections as they are. Plus, we really don't have a choice. We have, you know, diddly dee and diddly da. And, you know, however you look at it, we're losing our democracy and we're losing our Constitution.
So one thing that affects the elections, it's not exactly fraud, but it's questionable behavior, is how difficult it is for third parties to get into the action and become a part of the process.
Maybe. Well, that's part of the electoral dilemma, which I would solve if I were elected. We have some of the most draconian laws in the United States, really in the world, for entry. Now, they're not the worst by any stretch of the imagination. There are states in the union that are just unbelievable. But here, we have no actual system in which a third party or independent party or whatever can get full ballot access by doing X. Like, for example, in New York's state, if you get 50,000 votes for governor, you get complete ballot access from dog catcher all the way up to president. Here, you have to petition, petition, petition. Even in the Constitution state, we have unconstitutionality going on. So like when we wanted to get Jill Stein on the ballot 2 years ago in the last presidential election, what happened was that we ended up having a situation where we had to collect 17,000 signatures. Essentially, we had to collect 7,500 valid signatures, but you have to double the amount or get at least one. You have to get at least 50% beyond the minimum to make it. And there have been many candidates in this election that didn't make it. Like one gentleman was running for U.S. Senate. He didn't make it by a couple hundred signatures. Well, let's look at, you know, Rhode Island. If you want to run for president there, it's 1,000 signatures. In Vermont, it's 1,000 signatures. In Maine, it's 1,000 signatures. In New Hampshire, it's 3,000. In New Jersey, it's 800. As I said before, in New York, you get 50,000 votes for governor, and you get full ballot access. So we're sort of an odd state here in the middle of New England and the Mid-Atlantic states. And as I said before, there are states that are far worse. But the point is, why is this? And I think that I read an article by the past president of the Political Science Association. It was about 15 years ago. I read a book about it. I read the book. I saw him speak on YouTube. And what he basically said is the two parties are on life support. And there's two things that are keeping them alive. A lot of money, billions of dollars in control over ballot access. And I don't think the Secretary of State, our present Secretary of State, or really any of the Secretary of States that I've ever had any contact, takes any of this very seriously. They see third parties as nuisances. They refer to them as nuisances. You know, when they have to fill out the ballots and there's seven or eight parties, they immediately feel that this is too much work for them. If they like ballot access so much, why don't they fund it? Why did they make it an unfunded mandate for town clerks throughout Connecticut? Because that's where the rubber meets the road. The other part is some of these petitions are being actually checked by registrar voters, which is outrageous. These are the most political people elected in Connecticut, and they have oversight over our petitions.
Right, and I've been involved in those process of doing getting the petitions, and I know that they throw out a lot of signatures for very ridiculous reasons.
That's right.
Just as an excuse to throw them out, to say that you didn't reach the number that you need. So it's a little game going on there. Yeah. So, Mike, tell us about Connecticut's, how does it function? I know we have a paper ballot, right? We scan it. But as you said, the audit is only, what, 5%?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we know our elections aren't being stolen by miscounts?
Well, the machines could be fixed. Mr. Schwartzman at UConn is the one who programs all these systems, and I have a lot of faith in him. But again, it comes back to paper ballots and audits. Whatever the statistically significant number is, and I would figure that out by, you know, because I'm not smart enough to figure that out. I would bring in computer experts and statisticians and figure out how we would set up an audit, which would be essentially foolproof. And that could be done. Why they don't do it? It's costly. It's complicated. Plus, they like to steal elections. This has been going on since day one. We all know it goes on. The question is, to what level are we willing to accept it? We know for a fact that in Florida in 2000, the election was stolen. I mean, there's no question about that historically. And yet, nothing is being done about it.
Yeah, so another role of the Secretary of State, as you mentioned, was to work with businesses in the state. And maybe you can tell us, would you change anything there? What would you do to make it either easier or more difficult for businesses?
Okay, I make a distinction between businesses and corporations. Maybe that's an arbitrary decision on my part. I find that corporations are generally not creators of jobs, contrary to what you're being told. They have no connection, really, to people. They're not operating the public interest, necessity, and convenience. They're operating for profit only. There's lots of businesses that also operate for profit. When I was working, before I retired, I was in computer sales, and I did touchscreen systems. That's how I discovered the problems of fraud. But more importantly, I think that what we should be doing is asking whether these corporations or businesses are felons. Have they committed felonies? And if they're operating as illegal institutions, we should either pull their charters or watch them very closely. Why do we allow banks that were engaged in wholesale fraud? I mean, after all, in 2007, 2008, and even to this day, we know that over 6 million people lost their homes, mostly because of fraudulent loans. Now, that's a crime, as far as I'm concerned, and nothing was ever done about it. No bankers ever went to jail except one because he stole money from rich people. And I think the real problem here is we have to enforce the idea of these charters, because these charters give special privileges to the people that own them. For example, if a corporation goes bankrupt, they can't come after your personal assets. They're protected by the charter called, you know, an incorporation. They also get all sorts of tax benefits, all sorts of legal benefits. And now under Citizens United, they're actually people. They actually exist. Well, I don't know about it. I've never heard of, you know, how can you be your mother and father simultaneously? I mean, that's possible under this system that we have and the absurdity of Citizens mm-hmm. United. So I think that's my point of view. I'm open to any suggestions or ideas about how to reform such a system. But I think it's very clear the abuse is going on there and continues to go on. And if the Secretary of State doesn't feel she has or he doesn't have the power, they should talk to the Attorney General or to their prosecutor, their federal prosecutor, to find out, because petty crimes today are being prosecuted all over the place. But white collar crime is allowed, as they say in France, you know, arsonists are allowed to get away with what they're doing. But those who raise the alarm are immediately arrested.
Yeah. And we had talked about ballot access and how difficult it is for third parties. What would you do if you were elected to Secretary of State to make that easier for independent parties, third parties, to get on the ballot?
Well, I think if you said you have 1,000 or more people registered in your party, you should get ballot access. That would be one system. Another would be a petition of some sort to show some modicum of support, which would allow you, you know, ballot access for 4 to 6 years. There's a variety of ways that it could be done fairly and adequately. I mean, we don't want necessarily to allow any single person to get on simply because they're a citizen, although there's some legal precedent for that. There was a judge that said anybody could walk in the door and get on the ballot. Back in 2002, there was a case. It was a federal judge. He was overruled by the appellate court. But the issue, of course, is our present system is not good for democracy. Choice is what I'm all about. You know, choice is a very important word in American political life. And it represents the idea that people should be treated equally and fairly. And it also gives power to people. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's being denied. It's being denied because they don't want competition. These two parties don't want competition. Mm-hmm. They want other people to vote for them because they're there. And more the two parties look to me more and more like one party.
Right, I agree. And so now people have some options because you're the Green Party candidate.
Candidates, we're running a whole slate. Mm-hmm. So everybody in the state of Connecticut can vote for four of us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my point of view is leave something behind. Vote for a Green Party candidate means a couple of things. It means we don't have to go through this crazy ballot access system to petition. It also has another significance that a lot of people don't know, which is if we don't get 1% for one of our four statewide candidates, what's going to happen is that we won't be able to register people in many towns and cities in Connecticut, because we've had this in the past where we didn't run someone for higher office. And especially in Western Connecticut, towns and cities said, well, you didn't run anybody in our district, so you can't register your people here, which is another outrage.
Yeah, I always wonder why we can't just register to vote, why we have to register to vote in a party. You know?
Well, I think the real problem is the first thing that you get as a citizen when you become a registered voter is you get this little card. And question number 9 says, what party would you like to be a member of? And it says Republican, Democrat, or other. How postmodern? You know, I mean, other. And so we have a list of 200 or 300 different parties, one of which is, believe it or not, I haven't made up my mind yet, party. So, you know, there's actually a list somewhere on the website. That's another issue. The website mm-hmm. that the Secretary of State has is not really user-friendly. And I would upgrade that and make it a user-friendly place where candidates could put comments, or we could have all sorts of informative discussions. We have had no debates at all this year. And the organizations that usually do them, they're just not interested in doing them anymore. And there's also procedural problems with third parties. They don't want to allow us in because we are a nuisance. They don't know what to do with us. Mm-hmm. Well, what do you do with opinions and ideas? Do you simply censor them because they're not officially sanctioned by the two major parties?
If you go into a debate, you're going to bring up issues that they don't want to talk
exactly.
about. Exactly. So they don't want you there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Mike, tell me why should voters vote for you instead of the other candidates running?
Well, I think they should vote for me because I have a track record of being the people's Secretary of State. I took on the issue of voter verifiable paper trail and succeeded. We went to court about the Citizens Election Fund, which we haven't talked about, where I would, if I wanted to qualify for the $750,000 grant for Secretary of State, I would have to collect approximately 210,000 valid signatures, which means 380 or 400 or 450. How many does Denise Merrill or somebody else who will qualify? How many signatures do they have to get? None. None. So if you're a Democrat and Republican, you have to get none. It's impossible for any single person to collect those signatures, even an organization to collect those types of that numbers of signatures. And this goes on in the Constitution state. We got a decision from Judge Underhill that this violated our First and 14th Amendment rights, equal protection under the law. We went to the appellate court. We had one of the appellate judges support us. The other two voted against us. We brought it to the Supreme Court. It was thrown back at us. So, you know, bottom line is the fix is in. Third parties, independent candidates are really going to be able to get this money. And this is, quite frankly, very frightening because the judge also pointed out that the grants are too large. They shouldn't be, you know, for governor, $6 million. Our two candidates running for governor refused to take those grants, by the way. They're self-funding themselves for a variety of different reasons.
So a couple other little minor roles that come under the Secretary of State's purview is civic engagement. What would you do to enhance civic engagement?
Well, I think civic engagement is about what do secretaries do? They keep a record of all that goes on. Right now, the history of Connecticut is being done by another agency, the Connecticut Library. In California, it's the Secretary of State that keeps the historical record. And I think history is very important. I graduated back in the Jurassic period from UConn. I paid $620 a year, believe it or not, for room, board, and tuition. Now it's over $30,000 a year. That should tell you about history. You know, we used to have free education in this country. We don't have it anymore. So how do we create civic engagement? By getting people to hear different points of view, to make elections important, to make, for example, one of the proposals I would come forward with was to make Election Day a holiday in Connecticut to help people. Only 36.6% of the people vote during midterm elections. Why is that? I think it's partly because there's nothing to vote for. People are discouraged. They see the same pattern over and over again. The Congress has less power than the military-industrial complex. The presidency is under the control of institutions that we don't even know about. These are critical issues. Whether you agree or disagree with me, I mean, that's part of what the Secretary of State ought to be doing, is engaging people in debate and creating technologies and institutions which will encourage voting and not discourage people from being part of the civic process.
And another part of the job of the Secretary of State was, and these are minor, but kind of regulating the justice of the peace, providing the Justice of the Peace manual, and also publications connected to notary publics. Would you do anything to change those? Or?
Yeah, I think that that's somewhat locally controlled. I think that I am a Justice of the Peace. I applied in Wethersfield, Connecticut, and they granted me the office. I think that what I would do is professionalize a little bit more, you know, give training to people. I was just given a form. You're in it. You're it.
Right.
Yeah, you figure it out. Mm-hmm. I think that this is part of, you know, again, unfunded mandates. If we're going to have democracy, we got to pay for it. No one wants to pay for democracy or elections. But if you don't want to pay for elections and you don't want to pay for democracy, you're not going to have a democracy and you're not going to have real elections.
So, Mike, is there anything that you'd like to share with the listeners and voters that we haven't discussed so far?
I would just say go out and vote. I would say vote clean and vote green. I would say vote for the candidate who you believe in, because I believe that the only vote worth casting is one you can believe in.
And Mike, maybe you can also tell the listeners, who are the other Green Party candidates running for other offices in Connecticut?
Well, we have Ed Heflin, who's a big supporter of the public bank. We could do a program about that.
What's Ed Heflin running for?
A controller.
Okay.
And we have Peter Goslin running for attorney general. And we have Jeff Russell running for U.S. Senate. and I'm running for Secretary of State. So we
and
have.
Is it Tom McCormick running?
And Tom McCormick is running for Congress here in the first, yes. Mm-hmm. And Tom is 15 years the president of the Sierra Club. He's an anti-nuclear activist, and he's also been around the block on the F-35. And let me leave you with this. The F-35 is going to cost the American taxpayer $1.5 trillion with a T, and our student loans are $1.5 trillion. So my proposal is cancel the F-35 and get rid of all these loans, pay all these loans off to all these students that can't get their careers started and are living at home because they have no other option.
Now, are there other Green Party candidates running, like on a local level?
Yes. So what you can do is go to our website, just put in Google Connecticut Green Party. We have pictures, we have biographies, we have information. And if there's someone locally that's running, Barbara Barry's running for the Senate here in Connecticut. And there's a variety of other people running on a local level here in the greater Hartford area, like Mary Sanders is running in the 4th legislative seat here in Hartford. So all these people are worth taking a look at, but a look at other parties too. I would say the important thing is, as I said earlier, vote as if your life depended on it, because it might.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you for running for Secretary of State and all the time and energy that that takes and your commitment to those issues. And thanks for being on the show today.
Well, I really appreciate having the opportunity to be here. And I tip my hat off to you, Cheryl, for allowing me to be here today. And vote clean and vote green.
To learn more about Mike DeRosa or the other Green Party candidates in Connecticut, you can go to their website, which is ctgreenparty.org. And again, that's ctgreenparty.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Coming up, Trump, Pelosi, Schumer, we're changing the narrative in our discussion, or storming the wall, climate change, migration, and homeland security.
Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my light beside the golden door. Emma Lazarus.
The solution is simple. We make a long list. We write down all the immigrants on the list, and then we kick them all out. And then to make sure they don't come back, we build a wall. The wall, the big wall, a long wall, a thousand-mile wall, like the China Wall. But wider, but higher, but nicer. Good-looking wall. I'm going to build a wall. Don't worry, the wall is a beautiful wall.
The humor of who knew? Andrew Cuomo, the wall, the beautiful wall. Mr. Trump is going to take a trip to the border. And if you don't know, federal workers are going to be out in mass in protest against the shutdown of the government. Well, for the past 15 years, Todd Miller has researched, written about, and worked on immigration and border issues from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico divide for organizations such as Borderlinks, Witness for Peace, and NACLE. He did the brunt of his work in Tucson, Arizona, and Oaxaca, Mexico. He spent the majority of his life close to the U.S. international border, south and north. He's the author of Border Patrol Nation and his most recent book, Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security, and is busy at work on his next book, Empire of Borders, the Expansion of the U.S. Border Around the World, a different narrative than Trump, Pelosi, and Schumer on secure borders.
We can end this shutdown and meet the needs of the American people. Much of what we heard from President Trump throughout this senseless shutdown has been full of misinformation and even malice. The president has chosen fear. The fact is, on the very first day of this Congress, House Democrats passed Senate Republican legislation to reopen government and fund smart, effective border security solutions. But the president is rejecting these bipartisan bills, which would reopen government, over his obsession with forcing American taxpayers to waste billions of dollars on an expensive and ineffective wall, a wall he always promised Mexico would pay for. The fact is, President Trump has chosen to hold hostage critical services for the health, safety, and well-being of the American people and withhold the paychecks of 800,000 innocent workers across the nation. He promised to keep government shut down for months or years, no matter whom it hurts. That's just plain wrong. We all agree we need to secure our borders while honoring our values. We can build the infrastructure and roads at our ports of entry. We can install new technology to scan cars and trucks for drugs coming into our nation. We can hire the personnel we need to facilitate trade and immigration at the border. We can fund more innovation to detect unauthorized crossings. The fact is, the women and children at the border are not a security threat. They are a humanitarian challenge, a challenge that President Trump's own cruel and counterproductive policies have only deepened. And the fact is, President Trump must stop holding the American people hostage, must stop manufacturing a crisis, and must reopen the government. Leader Schumer?
Thank you, Speaker Pelosi. The President of the United States, having failed to get Mexico to pay for his ineffective, unnecessary border wall, and unable to convince the Congress or the American people to foot the bill, has shut down the government, hurting millions of Americans who are treated as leverage. President Trump has appealed to fear, not facts, division, not unity. Make no mistake, Democrats and the president both want stronger border security. However, we sharply disagree with the president about the most effective way to do it. Well, there's an obvious solution. Separate the shutdown from arguments over border security. There is bipartisan legislation supported by Democrats and Republicans to reopen government while allowing debate over border security to continue. There is no excuse for hurting millions of Americans over a policy difference. Federal workers are about to miss a paycheck. Some families can't get a mortgage to buy a new home. Farmers and small businesses won't get loans they desperately need. This president just used the backdrop of the Oval Office to manufacture a crisis, stoke fear, and divert attention from the turmoil in his administration. We can reopen the government and continue to work through disagreements over policy. We can secure our border without an ineffective, expensive wall. And we can welcome legal immigrants and refugees without compromising safety and security. The symbol of America should be the Statue of Liberty, not a 30-foot wall. So our suggestion is a simple one. Mr. President, reopen the government, and we can work to resolve our differences over border security. But end this shutdown now.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and Todd, thank you for being with us.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So there's Trump's insistence that we not reopen the federal government until his administration receives billions for the wall, the beautiful wall, the great wall, the new wall of slats and metal. But there's also the Democrats, whose legislative recommendation was that there be at least $1.3 billion for further border security. But Todd Miller, should there be another cent dedicated to the enforcement regime and increased militarization of the U.S. border with Mexico?
I would say no. I mean, the one thing that always really amazes me, just like watching how this proceeds, is the fact that there it's almost a historical narrative that's being presented. For example, if you just look at the budgets for border and immigration enforcement, and I was doing research recently, and I looked at the budget for the INS, which is the Immigration and Naturalization Service, in 1978, and this is for border and immigration enforcement. It was $287,000, and if you add together Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the budgets for 2018, it comes to $23 billion. And so I divided $23 billion by 100 or 286,000, and I came up with 80,000. It's 80,000 times more than it was in 1978, the budgets for border and immigration enforcement. I had to do the calculation five times to make sure I was seeing that number correctly. And my point in saying this is that over the last 30 years, particularly over the last 25 years, there's been a massive historical buildup of the border and immigration enforcement apparatus. And when we're presented like with the Oval Office speech or the Democratic response the other night, that whole like background is just not there, right? So if you take the $23 billion right now, it's more than that number is more than all other federal law enforcement agencies combined. So if you combine the FBI, the DEA, the U.S. Marshals, all of those combined, will be I think around $16 billion total. So the priority to towards border and immigration enforcement is very much there with the U.S. government. And how does that look? Well, there already is a wall, right, on the border. For example, I live in Tucson, about 60 miles away from the border in Nogales. And in 1994 in Nogales, there was a chain link fence that separated the United States from Mexico. And it was in 1994 when the Clinton administration initiated what they called Operation Safeguard, which is an operation as part of many different operations to bolster the border. And what happened was that the bulldozers came in, they took out the chain link fence, and they put in the first wall, the wall that we see in Nogales right now. In 1994, that wall was made of landing mats from the Vietnam and Persian Gulf Wars. And since then, it's been replaced to be a bollard style, which means bollard style is the metal slats, which look like bars. So if you're like at the wall, you're looking like through bars of a prison on either side of the border. It's a bollard style, about 20-foot high wall that separates the United States from Mexico. And so when you contemplate that massive increase of budgets over the last 25, 30 years, that's part of it, right? Now there's 650 miles approximately of walls and barriers on the U.S.-Mexico border, and reinforced by agents. Agents, for example, have gone from the year 1994, when there was about 4,000 agents, to approximately 21,000 agents today. So there's been a fivefold increase of agents. Technologies, billions of dollars have been dedicated to putting on high-tech surveillance cameras, night thermal cameras, thousands and thousands of implanted motion sensors, command and control centers where agents are looking in the monitors, Predator B unmanned surveillance, aerial surveillance equipment, which means drones that are flying overhead and doing surveillance of the border. And so billions and billions of dollars have been put into this apparatus and this is really important part of it, under what is called the prevention through deterrence strategy. Prevention through deterrence means that in the 1994, when the Clinton administration was first putting up these walls and reinforcing the border, the strategy was to cut off the traditional crossing points of people coming north. So cut off the cities, the urban areas where people were crossing, like El Paso, Nogales, Tijuana, San Diego, and Brownsville. And by cutting off those areas, that would then funnel people into desert areas like the Arizona desert, for example, which, as they had it conceived, would be a natural barrier, even could be mortal in the original policy memorandum, understanding that nobody could really walk through the desert in Arizona and have enough water, have enough food. But what has happened, and this is why this use of the word crisis is so interesting from the Trump administration, like the idea of a crisis on the border and the debunking of the Democrats that, well, there is no crisis on the border. Well, there's no crisis for white people on the border, right? There's a crisis for people crossing the border, and there long has been. It's a humanitarian crisis, and since the policy initiation of prevention through deterrence in 1994, there's been over 8,000 corpses recovered in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, and that's only the corpses that have been recovered. Thousands of families are still looking for their lost loved ones, and that's a bit of information that seems not to be reported very often. And so what people have been calling here for a long time a humanitarian crisis is pretty much put into oblivion. So that's what you look at when you're looking at the kind of panorama of the border enforcement apparatus as we are now. So this kind of buildup has been happening over 25 years. There was the Clinton administration operations, and then the post 9/11 reality, just, you know, tons, billions more in budgets, money came in with the forming of the Department of Homeland Security by the George W. Bush administration. And then the Obama administration, of course, did not stall out anything that was happening. They continued the border buildup. Obama was infamously called the deporter in chief, right, because of the more than 2.5 million people that were expelled from the country during his presidency. And that's So when the Trump administration took office in 2000 and January of 2017, they had all of this $20 billion annual budget at that point at its disposal, really. All the walls and drones and more than 250 detention centers and 20,000 people, 20,000 agents at ICE. You know, all of this was in his arsenal, and he's been increasing that since then. And that's why I say, you know, when he stands in front of, in the Oval Office, that there shouldn't be one more cent dedicated to border enforcement regime. And I say that to the Democrats too, who are insisting that, oh, we should put more surveillance technology out. Not one more cent should be put to it. Not only that, the real debate is, why do we have this gigantic apparatus, and isn't it about time to start reducing it rather than enhancing it?
Todd Miller, you really expose the underpinnings of what is an ever-expanding surveillance state. The military contractors that really rake in the fat profits, the bloated government agencies that keep expanding their tentacles while the core of our neighborhoods wither from neglect. I want you to talk more about some of the profiteers in this process and the implications of what I just said in terms of the ever-expanding surveillance state, because the devices and mechanisms on the border have otherwise been used against the broader populace in our neighborhoods and communities.
Absolutely. The one thing to mention is the border is the idea that the border is just the borderline is not true. The Border Patrol works in 100-mile zones, so their jurisdiction is a 100-mile zone. And the ACLU has called this a constitution-free zone. So you have to imagine the contour of the United States, a band going around, a 100-mile band that goes along the 2,000-mile U.S. southern border up the coast and then along the 4,000-mile U.S.-Canadian border. And you think about it, and whoa, that band devours the whole state of Maine, devours the whole state of Florida. And in that area, why the ACLU calls it a constitution-free zone is because Border Patrol can set up checkpoints. And I know that you're not going to find that on the coast of North Carolina yet, but as you have this expanding apparatus, it is increasingly going everywhere. Where I live, you can't go anywhere to the south of Tucson without going through a Border Patrol checkpoint. And where this is where, like, the ACLU says, well, your Fourth Amendment rights not to be searched nor seized is at the very least mangled, if not completely suspended. And one interview I had with a high official in the CB, Customs and Border Protection in Washington, told me we are, quote unquote, exempted from the Fourth Amendment. He told me that. I said, really? You're going to use the word exempted? So this idea that your rights are somewhat suspended in these 100-mile zones, and these 100-mile zones, there's a proliferation of checkpoints, and you find it really in the southern border more than anywhere else, but also increasingly on the northern border, but also this surveillance technology, as you mentioned, and all kinds of private companies that are cashing in on this. In Arizona, where I live, the newest contract has gone to the company Elbit Systems of America, which is a subsidiary of Elbit Systems, which is a Haifa, Israel-based company that was doing work on the West Bank Wall. As far as their technology. So the idea that Elbit brings is this idea of a quote-unquote what they call a smart wall. A smart wall is not just a wall or a barrier, as the Trump administration keeps saying, but it's also a barrier that's reinforced with high-tech surveillance technology, right? And so right now in southern Arizona, Elbit Systems is constructing what they're called integrated fixed towers, which are basically surveillance towers with these ground sweeping radar systems and cameras that can see 7 miles away and at night that then feed into the command and control center. So I bet you get this picture of a war zone that's being created in a high tech surveillance state, and that's exactly what's happening on the borderlands. And this is just one example. The contract with Elbit Systems could reach up to $1 billion if they continue with it. And that's just one example of many. There's other, big military manufacturers like General Dynamics, Halliburton or Kellogg Brown and Root, their subsidiary. Other, you know, I could go on and on, Boeing, on a list of different companies that have made money or getting contracts on the border, and really filling these 100-mile zones with these surveillance mechanisms, as well as, you know, that go on top of the checkpoints, including biometrics. And that's something that should just astonish people throughout the United States. You know, the idea of that facial recognition, the cameras are taking your pictures and you're getting like these digital databases, and the idea of this Orwellian Big Brother is certainly very much front and center. And then, of course, this is also a proving ground, right? As technology often is put on the border, it's tested out here, it's tested for the borderline enforcement, it's exported around the world, and it's also exported, if it's working, quote-unquote working, it then might, it's used as a, oh, this is working here, we can sell it for other things. So it expands in many different ways, further into the interior of the United States, to the northern border of the United States, and, you know, you can see, like, police units across the country that are using more and more, you know, technologies that have been first, you know, proven on the border, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, you have this whole kind of juggernaut, which is like an industrial complex that seems to have its tentacles just seem to be expanding out in all directions.
And the last minute, I do want to tell people you absolutely must get Todd Miller's latest book, Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security, and the previous book, Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security. But the last word, Todd, the issue of people arriving at our border, how should that be politically viewed, as opposed to really the kind of narrative that is of the Democrats and the Republicans most definitively? Who are these people? How should they be viewed?
The narrative of both in many different ways. There's some differences, of course, but the crux of it, and historically speaking, the narrative is the border militarization. It's building up the borders. There's different ideas of how to do it, but the same thing of this exclusion. And what is remarkable is that it's a militarized solution to issues that are socioeconomic, political in nature, and ecological now in nature. And these issues need to be addressed in many different other ways. Like, why does more than 70% of people in Central America live in a situation of economic poverty? What sort of economic policies have been not only implemented but imposed in places like Central America? What is the history of the United States and Central America in terms of militarism? What is, in ecological terms, the U.S.'s contribution in greenhouse gas emissions compared to countries in Central America? Like, if you go back to 1900, the United States has produced 687 times more greenhouse gases than Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras combined. And there are significant signs of climate change and climate disruption. And so, you know, there's all these other issues, and it's been treated with, you build a border wall and you put a lot of guns in people's hands, and that stops it. And completely what a wall does is dehumanize. It creates this idea that on the other side of the wall, you know, there's something bad's going to happen.
And there's where we're going to have to... I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Todd, but this is not the last time by any stretch of the imagination that Todd Miller is going to be with us. Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security. His other book, Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, and the issue of people arriving on our border is correctly a humanitarian one. They need to be treated like refugees, not criminals. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Thanks for being with us.
Everyone is crying out for peace. I say. get equal rights and justice.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
LGBTQ people, grappling with our identities can be complicated and difficult. So discovering a label that fits how we're feeling about sexuality and gender helps us understand that we're not alone and that there's other people like us.
If it was simply a matter of sexual choice or to get work in jazz, William Lee Tipton began to more actively work to pass as a male. But by 1940, was living as a man in private life as well.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Queer couples in Japan and Hong Kong challenge marriage inequality, the secret life of a gender-bending jazz giant, and do labels help us or hurt us? All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the 3 weeks ending January 5th, 2019. Lawyers for 10 gay and lesbian couples in Japan announced in late December that they would be filing a lawsuit against the federal government for failing to open civil marriage to them. Article 24 of Japan's constitution says that marriage shall be based only on the mutual consent of both sexes. Equality activists claim that the emphasis is on mutual consent and not on gender. The government argues that the term husband and wife in the civil code and family registration laws refers only to heterosexual couples. The 10 couples, who according to the Kyoto News Service are also seeking financial compensation, will file the lawsuit in district courts throughout the country, including Tokyo and Nagoya in February. One of the attorneys, Shinya Maizono, told the press that, "We want our call to be widespread so that the freedom to marry will be recognized for everyone." 8 municipalities in Japan, including Fukuoka and Osaka, offer limited local benefits to registered same-gender couples. But the conservative government of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe continues to resist any action at the federal level to legally recognize lesbian and gay couples. Meanwhile, university students Misato Kawasaki and Mayu Otaki, each in her early 20s, have announced their plan to tie the knot in all 26 countries that have opened civil marriage to same-gender couples. They promise to post pictures of the ceremonies on their blog during their six-month adventure in an effort to convince readers that Japan should become the 27th country.
A 21-year-old gay university student and his 31-year-old activist partner filed suit this week in Hong Kong's High Court demanding the right to marry. Attorneys for the couple, identified only as TF and STK, argue that denying them that right violates equality requirements of both the city's Bill of Rights and basic law. Same-gender couples have challenged the Chinese city's laws covering spousal visas and taxation, but this is the first lawsuit to deal directly with full marriage equality. According to the South China Morning Post, 2 judicial reviews of the case were held last year, but were kept under wraps until the preliminary hearing made the case public on January 3rd. Justice Anderson Chow Kaming approved a hearing for the couple, but he said the court would first hear a related case involving a 29-year-old lesbian seeking a civil partnership with her female partner. He said that case would raise the same basic issues involved in the gay couple's marriage lawsuit. Hong Kong's one and only openly queer legislator, Raymond Chan Chi-Twen, acknowledged concerns that pushing for full marriage rights head-on might be premature and result in an adverse outcome that could delay equality for many more years. But he said that at least some people in the LGBTQ community want to have their rights fought for on any and all levels. Other active lawsuits in Hong Kong courts involve a gay senior immigration officer who's seeking civil service spousal benefits for his male partner and another by a gay couple seeking equal access to public housing.
2 women became the first queer couple to officially get married in Austria a few minutes after midnight on January 1st. Nicole Koponik and Daniela Payer walked down the aisle in the southern Austrian city of Velden. After years of advocacy by determined equality activists, Austria's constitutional court decided in December 2017 that the civil institution should be open to same-gender couples, but they delayed their ruling from taking effect until January 1st of this year. Even townspeople and officials got involved in planning the wedding. Velden Mayor Ferdinand Vuk said that, "It was a great pleasure and honor for us that Nicole and Daniela got married here. The brides are each 37 years old and were engaged for 4 years. Until now, gay and lesbian couples in the heavily Roman Catholic country could only enter into less than equal registered partnerships. But Koponik and Payer decided to wait until they could legally marry. Now, Koponik said, everyone has the chance to decide for themselves if they want a marriage for all or if they want a registered partnership." The court allowed the 5 successful plaintiff couples in the 2017 lawsuit to marry before the ruling came into force.
The Kingston Fire Department is investigating the cause of a fire that virtually burned down the headquarters of JFLAG, Jamaica's leading queer rights group, on the evening of December 30th. A statement posted to the group's Facebook page thanked the first responders and said they were grateful that no one was hurt in the blaze. We will be providing an update when further details become available and how we foresee this impacting our programs, the statement said, as well as to advise on the kind of support we will require to continue our operations. JFLAG was founded in 1998 in a nation considered by many to be the most homophobic in the world. People who are even perceived to be LGBTQ suffer routine threats, harassment, and violence on the Caribbean island. Jamaican police are often disinterested at best or complicit at worst.
Pakistan's first ever Trans Pride March was held in the city of Lahore on December 29th. Transgender celebrity and activist Cami Sid added name recognition to the festivities. The procession of trans people and their allies kicked off with a press conference featuring leading activists. Transgender murder victims of hate violence were remembered, in addition to expressions of support for the trans community. The Daily Pakistan reported that the colorful, peaceful, and celebratory march drew a large crowd of onlookers as it made its way through the streets of the country's second largest city. Lawmakers in Pakistan guaranteed the fundamental rights of trans people in 2018 and made it against the law for businesses and employers to discriminate against them. But Trans Pride marchers protested the government's refusal to implement those reforms. British colonial-era laws criminalizing lesbian and gay people, however, remain on the books, and convictions of consensual adult same-gender sex can bring prison terms of up to 10 years. Unlike neighboring and often antagonistic India, there's no movement in Pakistan to repeal anti-gay sex laws. And sexual and gender minorities in general continue to face harsh societal hostility.
The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit has overturned the decision of a federal judge in the nation's capital that blocked the implementation of President Donald Trump's ban on transgender people serving in America's military. The appeals court rejected on January 4th the argument that the ban violates the constitutional equality rights of transgender people, and deferred to the Pentagon to determine how best to run the military. It was the first legal victory for the Trump trans ban after several defeats. Other federal courts have issued injunctions against implementation of the ban, so there are no immediate consequences of the D.C. appeals court ruling. Trump announced an across-the-board ban on military service by trans people on Twitter in July 2017. The proposal has since undergone more than one government study and various permutations before then-Defense Secretary James Mattis announced details of a trans ban last year. Supporters claim that it allows qualified trans people to serve, but critics point out that they can only serve in the gender they were assigned at birth, a trans variation on the now-defunct Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that required lesbian and gay service members to stay in the closet. The Trump administration has already asked the Supreme Court to take up the issue. According to Reuters, the justices are scheduled to consider whether or not to hear three separate government appeals of those injunctions during a private conference on January 11th. Like so many of his other actions, Trump's proposal attempts to overturn yet another policy of his predecessor, Barack Obama. That administration had welcomed qualified transgender troops and also provided them with the medical care needed to transition if they so desired.
And finally, in happier government news, the Royal Canadian Mint announced in late December that a new $1 coin would be issued in 2019 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the repeal of laws criminalizing private consensual adult same-gender sex. The Mint said the exact details of the design are being kept secret to maximize the impact when the coin is released. Leaks suggest that the coin will feature the word equality in both English and French, Canada's two official languages, and a stylized overlapping of two human faces within a large circle. The repeal process began in 1967 under then soon-to-be Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, father of current PM Justin. Parliament approved decriminalization 2 years later. According to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau approved the design of the commemorative coin on December 14, 2018. The elder Trudeau proposed the repeal of anti-gay sex laws while serving as Canada's Justice Minister. "There's no place for the state," he said, "in the bedrooms of the nation."
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the 3 weeks ending January 5th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
What Tipton did for jazz, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Dorothy Lucille Tipton was born in 1914 in Oklahoma City. She took up the piano and saxophone, but as a female, she couldn't join the school band. To perform in an almost exclusively male profession, she began dressing as a man and quickly found work playing in honky-tonks. Now, as Billy Tipton, he became a talented pianist, saxophone player, and he sang in a tenor voice. In nightclubs, women swooned over his boyish appearance. He later made jazz records with his newly formed Billy Tipton Trio. Married five times, Tipton managed to maintain his charade with all of his wives. Falling ill in the 80s, he avoided doctors to keep his gender a secret, and a bleeding ulcer cost him his life. After paramedics tried everything they could to revive him, his long-kept secret was a secret no more. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Giz Bow.
Just 1 minute is not enough to tell the story of Billy Tipton, even if it's a Rainbow Minute. He deserves a This Way Out music focus, and our Steve Sims has one.
Billy Tipton was born Dorothy Lucille Tipton on December 29, 1914, in Oklahoma City. The Tipton Sax Quartet were born, the Billy Tipton Memorial Saxophone Quartet, in 1988 in Seattle.
Later in the program.
The thing about gay culture that bugs me the most...
Gay comic actor Nick Dadani.
As a gay man, you're expected to label yourself, you know? You have bears who are the big burly gay men. You have twinks who are the younger slender gays. And you have otters and cubs and koalas, probably. What if we started doing that to straight guys? You'd have the weasel. That's the guy that pretends to respect women in order to get laid. And then you'd have the... Well, I guess that's it.
Here's my label maker. It's bigger than my brain. Let's put a tag on everyone and then begin again. Don't you dare remove it or change it anytime. There's no way to improve it. It's there in print. That's fine. Who you are or what you do. I'll label you, you label me, then we'll know who we're supposed to be, and we can live obliviously.
Stuck with a label? Looking for one? Consider the pros and cons with our resident queer youth commentators.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Andrew, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Dante talks about the existence of very specific labels in the LGBTQ community and the implications of using these narrow labels as opposed to broader ones.
What is the purpose of a label? In the LGBTQ community, labels can be useful for both ourselves and others. They help us define and understand something about ourselves and feel like part of a community of people like us. For LGBTQ people, grappling with our identities can be complicated and difficult. So discovering a label that fits how we're feeling about sexuality and gender helps us understand that we're not alone and that there's other people like us who feel the same way we do. An example is the divisions we see within asexuality. The term asexual describes a person who doesn't experience sexual attraction. But within that label, some people consider there to be over 15 variations of asexuality. For example, some asexuals don't experience romantic attraction, while others do, to members of the same or opposite sex or even a wider range of genders. Some experience sexual attraction, but only after they've already connected emotionally with someone. Excessively specific labels are becoming common, especially on the internet, but perhaps each specific identity doesn't warrant a specific label. And perhaps even more, it doesn't warrant renouncing larger labels and communities. Having many labels that are too specific can actually be more confusing than useful, even within the LGBTQ community. And outside the community, overly specific labels may be unrecognizable and may antagonize people, making it difficult to understand the variety that exists within our community. Excessively specific labels can look arbitrary or made up to outsiders, especially people who don't know what they mean. This can make LGBTQ identities look more trivial. Turning identity into a list of dictionary-style descriptions distracts from the personal reality and humanity of these identities, along with the stories behind them and the real people they describe. Excessively specific labels also don't serve the other important purpose of labels, connecting with a community. Rather, they cut communities into specific and isolated slices, emphasizing differences rather than similarities and shared experiences. This can be damaging to the larger communities. Feeling connected to our communities is important to LGBTQ people, and fracturing those communities makes it harder to feel connected and to feel that there are many other people like us. This creation of more and more specific labels encourages the notion that labels have to be limiting. The point of labels is to roughly and concisely communicate identities. They were never intended to be all-encompassing descriptions. To make communication easier and strengthen our communities, I think we should try to avoid the idea that labels have to be comprehensive descriptions and limit using overly specific labels, especially when it means decreasing the use of more unifying labels. When it truly matters, nothing is more effective than fully describing your identity. But labels are just tools to connect, and connecting with others with similar identities does not have to mean relinquishing our own uniqueness. Everyone, both inside and outside the LGBTQ community, should realize that vast diversity can exist within a community or label. If labels aren't as often interpreted to be all-encompassing or limiting, people won't feel that they have to withdraw themselves from larger communities because of their differences.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit independent producer based in New York. Our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Isn't life beautiful? Isn't life gay? Isn't life the perfect thing to pass the time away?
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens, and you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
Now I'm fascinated.
And those who love them.
Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
And that's the truth.
Talk music and avoid politics, or vice versa, queer music maestro Steve Sims treads the tightrope in between the two for his latest This Way Out music focus.
Oh, 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 listen to the music. Oh, 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 listen to the music. Oh, 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 listen to the music all the time.
As I set out to do research for this segment, I found myself in a quagmire of current events, from white male privilege and living your truth, to non-binary gender issues and authenticity. I had to step back and focus on the music, specifically the late jazz musician band leader of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, Billy Tipton, and a group of musicians from the Northwest named the Tipton's Sax Quartet. ¶¶ That was Get Dirty, Do It Now, from the Tipton's Sax Quartet's 2017 album, Cookbook. Billy Tipton was born Dorothy Lucille Tipton on December 29, 1914, in Oklahoma City. The Tipton Sax Quartet were born, the Billy Tipton Memorial Saxophone Quartet, in 1988 in Seattle. With a few exceptions in the 30s and 40s, jazz was a man's world. There was an unwritten code in the jazz world that women just didn't get hired. Whether it was simply a matter of sexual choice or to get work in jazz, William Lee Tipton began to more actively work to pass as a male by binding his breasts and patting his pants. At first, he only presented as male in performance, but by 1940 was living as a man in private life as well, and lived the life of a man until January 21st, 1989, and the post-mortem revelation that he was biologically female. This is the Billy Tipton Trio with the song The Man I Love off the 1957 album Sweet Georgia Brown. Billy's image was one of a gentleman, a heterosexual male, with everything that that implied in 1940s America. In 1958, Tipton had a chance to break into the big time when the group was offered a recording contract and a gig opening for Liberace in Reno, Nevada, at more than double its usual fee. But Tipton said no, perhaps for fear that it might expose Billy's bold solution to gaining a certain amount of recognition in what was largely a man's world. This is the song number 6 from the Tipton Sax Quartet's 2008 album, Laws of Motion. John Otto was one of the Tipton Sax Quartet's founding members in 1988, and at that time was known as Babs Helly. He also coined the group's original name, the Billy Tipton Memorial Saxophone Quartet. He left the group in 1990, and more currently has done work as a transgender activist. This is Impish, off the Tipton's 2010 album, Strange Flower. Amy Denio is an original member of the Billy Tipton Memorial Saxophone Quartet, dating from the band's very first rehearsal at her house in the fall of 1988. She was with them until 1996 and then took a hiatus. This is Recipe for Disaster, off the Tipton's We Love to Meet Again live album from 2016. In 2002, Amy and Jessica Lurie, another original member, reformed the band, now renamed the Tipton's Sax Quartet. The fourth founding member was Marjorie Demuck. Marjorie, who had a master's in music from Boston University, passed away in 2011 at the age of 58. This is Drive from the 2005 album by the same title. One of the things I really enjoy about the Tipton Sax Quartet are the names of their songs, and they've recorded 8 albums. This song from 1996 is called Disgruntled Postal Worker. One of the challenges I faced when I set out to research this piece was my frustration over the information swirling around the current debate about non-binary gender, males, females, and LGBT civil rights. For me, the issue boils down to a human's right to feel authentic, live their truth, versus the potential that another maybe at some point possibly come face to face with this in the real world for a few minutes. This is the Billy Tipton Trio in 1957 with Sweet Georgia Brown. I've been face to face with the issue of non-binary gender and LGBT civil rights my whole life. As a kid, I had the honor to know Billy Tipton. He was my neighbor, and his adopted sons and I went to school and were in scouts together. I worked with a transgender woman in one of my first volunteer work experiences. My former brother-in-law is now a transgender woman. All three are good, decent people who I believe are better for their paths. Billy Tipton was named by Time magazine as one of 21 transgender people who influenced American culture. When it comes to non-binary gender, the T, or the Q in LGBTQ, and the LG and B, their contribution to music is undeniable. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Sims.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Steve Sims and Sarah Sweeney and Michael LeBeau, produced with Brian DeSazer. The Rainbow Minute was read by Giz Bow and produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns. And Outcasters Andrew and Dante were produced by Mark Sofis. Impetus, Tipton's Sax Quartet, and the Billy Tipton Trio performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed Red Theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can lend a hand by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUNR Reno, Nevada, WRIR Richmond, Virginia, CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Happy New Year and stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
The studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Mohandas Gandhi is a gigantic figure, a deep and dazzling thinker whose insights fueled not just India's drive for independence from British rule, but countless subsequent struggles for social justice and political emancipation. And yet, how much clarity do we have about Gandhi's ideas and what they meant for achieving truth, for mastering our desires, for acting ethically in the face of oppression? What was Gandhi searching for, and what avenues did he choose to take in that quest? And what did Gandhi think about modern civilization and how it affected people's thoughts and actions? Manu Samnotra has contributed an enlightening chapter about Gandhian thought and practice to the new volume, Constructing the Pluriverse, the Geopolitics of Knowledge. Manu is assistant professor of political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. His chapter has the title, Experimenting with Freedom, Gandhi's Political Epistemology. When Manu Samnotra joined me recently, I asked him what he was trying to do with this chapter.
So the invitation that I received from the editor, Bernd Reiter, was that he wanted us to think, the contributors to the volume, to think about ways of organizing knowledge in non-Western context. And so the challenge was to try to think through, for I think all the contributors, how non-Western ways of organizing knowledge can open doors to decolonial practices. So, for example, if you think of knowledge only in terms of scientific rationality, what do we miss? What political avenues are close to us? And so, Bernd, my colleague here at USF, invited me to write something about Gandhi, and I thought this was a very interesting opportunity and challenge, because Gandhi is not a systematic thinker. He is someone who is interested in political practice, although he wrote quite a bit. His collected works run to, I think, about 98 volumes, and each of which is about 400 to 500 pages long. So here's someone who is not a systematic thinker, and yet has been exceptionally influential, not only in India, but also internationally, in shaping a political practice that tends to flip the script on the ways in which the colonizers or the oppressors against whom the practice of civil disobedience was applied wanted to organize the political field.
How important to Gandhi was the search for truth?
I think truth was absolutely fundamental to Gandhi's political epistemology. He called himself a votary of truth, and he referred to truth as the summum bonum of life. Now, truth, however, is a pretty expansive concept, even in Western philosophy. In Gandhi's case, however, truth is multifaceted. So let's say for the moment, when I say, but Gandhi says that he's a votary of truth, let's imagine the big truth, truth encompassing all of human existence, as starting with a capital T. But Gandhi also understood that truth is multifaceted. All of us have access to a small sample of that larger truth. And so when we engage in dialogic conversations with each other, when we try and approach each other with goodwill to understand what the causes of political disagreement are, we come closer to the larger truth. If we were to access the larger truth, and Gandhi firmly believed this, we would discover that we are all part of one human family, that the distinctions and differences between us are ephemeral. They have real consequences and they have real substance behind them, real histories behind them. But these differences, these chasms that separate us, are themselves dependent on a larger truth that we are all part of one family, one human family. And perhaps in Gandhi's case sometimes, because he was a vegetarian, also a non-human family as well. All beings are united together.
Now, at least one word in Hindi for truth is satya, and that brings us to one of his key concepts, his notion, satyagraha. What does that term as a whole mean literally, and what did it mean to Gandhi?
So the term satyagraha was a neologism. So Gandhi is in South Africa, where he has gone as a lawyer, and he is involved in the well, at this point, early stages of the anti-apartheid movement. And the form of protest that he develops is entirely novel. And the closest analogs that he can find to it are the terms passive resistance or civil disobedience. Of course, he prefers the latter, but passive resistance is the one that is nearly always used to define what he is doing. And in fact, many years later, when he came back to India, reporters from the New York Times describing the practice of satyagraha could not help but accentuate its passive elements. So just to give you an example, waves after waves of satyagrahis walk up to baton-wielding policemen who strike them on the head, and the satyagrahis don't respond. So to the Western eyes, that seemed like a certain kind of passivity. Gandhi did not like that, because Gandhi thought that there's something very active at the core of what he was advocating in South Africa and then later in India. And so he, in his local newspaper that he had started, he asked his readers to recommend a name. And I will not go into the other history of it, but basically he comes up with, alongside the contribution of other people, he comes up with the word satyagraha. Now, as you mentioned, satyagraha is a compound word of satya, which means truth, and agraha, which means firm grasping. And so together, they are meant to indicate a firm grasping of the truth, or sometimes, as he referred to it in his English writings, as truth force. Now, the word satya itself, and this is sort of ties to what I said earlier, the word satya itself is derived from the word sat, which means being. So to give you an example, if you look at the history of Western philosophy in Plato and Parmenides, the idea is that being comes before non-being. And the principle here is that if non-being came before being, non-being would annihilate being. So being has to have preference. And so for Gandhi, being has a certain kind of precedence over non-being. Truth has precedence over misleading interpretations of reality. And so when someone engages in satyagraha, they're insisting on the truth that I mentioned earlier, that we're all part of one human family. They're firmly insisting on this truth.
What does satyagraha have to do with dialogue and with the bringing together of different perspectives?
So dialogue is an integral part of satyagraha. So Gandhi once said that, quote, every case can be seen from no less than 7 points of view, all of which are probably correct by themselves, but not correct at the same time and in the same circumstances. So if truth is, as I mentioned earlier, multifaceted, and the satyagrahi is insisting on the truth, then in order to capture that capital T truth, the satyagrahi needs the corroboration of truth from other people. And so dialogue is fundamental to how a satyagrahi is able to actually capture or understand the truths that the satyagrahi claims to be insisting upon.
You write that for Gandhi, the first step in any satyagraha struggle is to discover the conditions one seeks to address and to look at those conditions from a number of perspectives, not just the perspective of the oppressed. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is kind of important because at some level, you know, Gandhi wants to make sure that if you're insisting upon the truth, you actually understand it in all its facets. So in hindsight, and of course we know this now, many of the moments in which he initiated a satyagraha movement, those instances, the truth or justice was on the side on behalf of whom Gandhi started this movement. But as an actor going into the situation, you do not know what the reality is. And so two things are important. One, you try to find out as much as you can about both sides of the situation. So for example, one of the first satyagraha movements at India, that Gandhi starts in India, is in a village of Champaran, where the farmers are being forced to plant indigo and have to pay high taxes, and they are suffering as a result of the policies of the British government. So when Gandhi goes there, he tries to find out from all sides what the reality is. And of course, he finds out very quickly that, in fact, the farmers are the ones who are in the right. But that, besides that point, the other important thing that's happening here when the satyagrahi tries to find out what everybody thinks is that he's trying to show his goodwill. He's trying to show that, look, I'm not here as an ideologue who's come in and have already, in my mind, set the terrain of a political disagreement in advance. I'm here to actually learn. And so I'm willing to be as persuaded by you as by the people who have called me in to help them organize their protests. And so it sort of sets, as a first movement, the terms by which the future struggle will follow. And in this case, it's by showing a certain kind of goodwill.
Yeah, and this is very profound because a lot of people who engage in a political struggle would tend to see the opposing side as the enemy and therefore not deserving of goodwill, not deserving of a kind of positive interest and maybe compassion.
Right. And so as a result, I mean, so I rely on the work of other very great Gandhi scholars. I have in mind the work of Karuna Mantena, who basically says that Gandhi is in some ways a realist. That, you know, we tend to think of Gandhi as an idealist who is, you know, attached to political principles that cannot possibly be implemented in the world as we actually have inherited it. But these other interpreters of Gandhi argue, and I think correctly, that Gandhi is actually quite aware that the terms by which we start a political dialogue, the terms by which the entire thing is set into motion, has to be done correctly. You have a greater chance of succeeding in your political aims if you are receptive to the aims of those against whom you're opposed. And so again, going back all the way to the idea of truth as being, you know, that we're all part of one human family, Gandhi believes at a spiritual level, that he will not lose anything by learning about what other people think. He will actually gain a greater insight into the shared reality. And perhaps in the process, by showing this goodwill, he might actually persuade them that they too can learn about the shared reality and come to understand the people they're opposed to as, in fact, their allies in the future.
That's Manu Samnotra. He teaches in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. And we are talking about an article he wrote about Gandhi's thought called Experimenting with Freedom that appears in the new volume Constructing the Pluriverse, not the universe, but the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. It's edited by Bernd Reiter and published by Duke University Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Ahimsa, which is, I think, typically translated as nonviolence. This is another notion prominently associated with Gandhi. What does goodwill, the goodwill you've been talking about, have to do with ahimsa?
So etymologically, the word ahimsa is a negation of the word himsa, which is harm. And ahimsa has two different aspects to it, a negative aspect and a positive aspect. So the negative aspect is fairly straightforward and simple enough to understand. If you want to practice ahimsa, if you want to practice nonviolence, then do not harm other beings. And this part of ahimsa is perhaps fundamental to every attempt at implementing the idea of civil disobedience. I'm not using the word satyagraha, the word civil disobedience here. Satyagraha, however, depends also upon the positive side of ahimsa, which is not only will I not harm you, I also want to show you love and compassion. And so this is part of the goodwill that is integral to how Gandhi advocated the practice of satyagraha. Not only is your well-being at the core of how I live my life, which is by not harming you physically, I further show you my concern for your good, for your well-being by showing you compassion and love. But that ultimately is what I am motivated by, and not by greed or desire, or selfish desire, or ideological inflexibility.
Yeah, and as you put it in another way in your article, although I like the way you just expressed it, there's a desire to do the opponent good. There's a desire for others' well-being.
Yes. And so certainly this is a very important facet of how Gandhi conducted his politics. Now, here I want to make a distinction between the idealized, in some ways, image of Gandhi that we have and how Gandhi himself would have been wished to be understood, and perhaps the a more skeptical but no less appreciative picture of Gandhi. So Gandhi wants to do good for the people who he thinks have been misled by, and we'll talk more about this, I hope, in a few moments, by modern civilization. And he wants to show them love. But it's a strict kind of love. It is not a love that says you can have whatever you want. It is a love that is premised on the belief that what you are doing is wrong for you, even though you don't know it. And it is my act of love for you that I'm going to show you that your path is wrong, and I'm going to resist the policies that you need to in order to pursue the path that you're on. And so it is not a lovey-dovey kind of love where everything goes. It is actually, in some ways, a very harsh kind of love that tries to wean the political opponent away from his or her reliance on violence.
What did Gandhi's asceticism have to do with his effort to cultivate goodwill toward his opponents, to desire the well-being of others who he may have disagreed with?
I think ascetic practices are at the core of Gandhi's politics. They're almost inseparable from them. And in fact, if you read even the most commonly read stuff by Gandhi, which is his autobiography and his book, The Hind Swaraj, and some other things here and there, he constantly talks about his various attempts at controlling his desires. Now, I'm going to sort of try to telescope this out to the larger question of ahimsa by starting somewhere else, which is, for Gandhi, passions are dangerous. They're dangerous because the hankering after things that passion generates and fuels makes us insensitive to a means and ends distinction. So the idea here is that if I am anxious for something and I want something and I really am hankering after it, at some point I will stop paying any kind of ethical attention to how those things are acquired. To give an example from our own contemporary politics, vegetarianism, something that Gandhi was very, very seriously committed to. Most of us, those of us who eat meat, love, you know, barbecue cookouts and burgers and, you know, chicken wings. Most of us also don't really want to know the processes through which this food becomes available to us. And so Gandhi is saying that if we give in to our desires, if we are driven by our desires, then we will become insensate to the processes by which the things that we want have become available to us. So what Gandhi wants us to do is to ask ourselves, why do we want something? And this is not something that we will learn entirely as the result of some kind of intellectual process. We actually have to live it. And so Gandhi advocates ascetic practices or an ascetic lifestyle in order to understand why we want something. And as a second step, and this is the core idea, in order to regain control over ourselves, to regain control over our desires. Because when we are in control of our desires, we are in a better position to understand where our desires come from. And then, now we've come to the more political, directly political point, we understand what is at stake in our disagreement with our political opponent. We understand why we want to have, you know, a certain end come about, because we are in better control of our desires. Whereas our political opponent, driven by her or his own desires, is unable to understand why they want the things that they want, and therefore are consistently occluding the very important distinction between means and ends.
Desires. Well, I know Gandhi had quite a bit to say about the extent to which desires, material desires, are fueled by civilization, by modern civilization. This is a big question, I know, but what did Gandhi think about modern civilization, and what was the fundamental target of his critique? What aspect of modern civilization did he not approve of?
So for me personally, this has always been the part of Gandhi that takes my breath away. The audacity almost of his intellectual gymnastics, and I think really well done gymnastics at that, opens the space for political thinking in ways that I think most political thinkers that I've spent my time reading are unable to do. But in order to get at that, we have to first understand what civilization means for Gandhi. And so I'm going to quote from Gandhi here. Quote, "Civilization is that mode of conduct which points out to man the path of duty. Performance of duty and observance of morality are convertible terms. To observe morality is to attain mastery over our mind and our passions. So doing, we know ourselves." So when I say that it's the sheer audacity of what Gandhi is doing here is, when I say that, it's because by defining civilization in this way, Gandhi is able to flip the script, something I had mentioned earlier, on the dominant ideological narratives surrounding colonialism. I think as most of your listeners would know, the colonial claim, at least in the case of the British Empire, the colonial claim was, we are civilized, you are children on the civilizational ladder, and through our tutelage, you too can be civilized. When the colonizer says that they are civilized and the Indians are not, what the colonizer believes is that the colonizer has modern industrial capitalism as the engine that will make civilization possible. Correspondingly, because the Indians lack in modern industrial capitalism, they are not civilized. And therefore, the task of civilization is to bring railroads and to bring modern medicine and modern education to Indians, to the benighted masses of India. When Gandhi defines or redefines civilization not as the things that will become available to us, the conveniences we will have, faster travel, better medical health care, more scientific education, when he says that's not what civilization is, but the performance of our duties and our moral sensibilities, when he says that's what civilization is, he is flipping the entire script. And what he's essentially saying is that modern civilization, as it's claimed by the British, operates on the principle of multiplying your desires. You want more things. You hanker after more things. If we redefine civilization not as the things that we want and the things that we claim a right to have, but the things that we must do, we draw a boundary around what is our due. And proceeding from that perspective, we are likelier to engage in other regarding behavior than we would if we were simply driven by the conveniences of modern civilization, as defined by the British.
That's the voice of Manu Samnotra, Manu Samnotra. He's assistant professor of political theory at the University of South Florida, and he has contributed a chapter about Gandhi's thought to a new volume. It's called Constructing the Pluriverse, not universe, but pluriverse, Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. In this chapter that you've written, you point to a book that Gandhi wrote. It's called Hind Swaraj, and he is, in a sense, talking back to or engaging with some of the revolutionary thinkers in India who wanted to achieve political independence in a certain kind of way, sometimes including violence. What did Gandhi in this text say about what he thought these revolutionary thinkers, or at least some of them, were in fact trying to do, which wasn't necessarily good for India?
So the text that you mentioned, Hind Swaraj, is one of the most important things that Gandhi wrote. And he wrote this in quite a bit of hurry on his way back from London, where he had gone to represent the case of the Indian workers living in South Africa. And while he was there, he met a number of people, some of whom would become very influential later on in Indian politics, including the founder, or the intellectual sort of founder, of the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, which is RSS, which is the parent, ideological parent body of the current ruling party in India, the BJP. And so all of these young men who are in London at the time meet Gandhi, who is effectively a nobody on the Indian political scene, because he's been living in South Africa for a few years at this point. And they're all taken in by what's happening around them. For one, they're quite taken in by the Japanese model of industrialization. They think that Japan has found a way by which to respond to the challenges of the colonial imbalance of power. They have industrialized, and now they are able to respond as equals to Europe. Also within Europe, there are various political movements, especially in Italy, that these young revolutionaries are quite taken in by. And when Gandhi meets them, for the first time, he encounters an ideological position very clearly stated that is completely contrary to his own. And so on the ship journey back, he writes this text, which is in the form of a dialogue between an editor, which is meant to represent Gandhi's own position, and a reader, which is meant to represent the position of the young men that he encountered in London. And the conversation is about, how does India gain independence? What do we do? And the reader says, we need to basically become like the English. And that's how we will end up getting Swaraj. The word Swaraj means self-rule. Swa means self, and Raj meaning rule. And as always, here too, Gandhi flips the script. And he says, look, your understanding of Swaraj is completely wrong. You think Swaraj is simply about kicking out the British and taking over what they leave behind. One beautiful line in this text, he says, quote, in effect, your proposal means this, that we want English rule without the Englishman. You want the tiger's nature, but not the tiger. That is to say, you would make India English, and when it becomes English, it will be called not Hindustan, but Englistan. This is not the Swaraj that I want. So Gandhi is saying independence, self-rule, requires a total rethinking of the political mechanisms and the political institutions and the political motivations that guide the Indians who hope to be independent. And this rethinking starts at the very basic level of how we understand our own desires. And so what colonialism has done very well is that it has made all of these things, all of the gifts of modern civilization, easily available to Indians. One of the examples is cheaper cloth. The factories in Lancashire are sending cotton products back to India, and now Indians have cheaper clothing available to them. What the people who buy this clothing don't realize is that the success of Lancashire, the mills in Lancashire, their success is premised on the impoverishment of the local producers in India. And so Gandhi is saying, without rethinking what it is that we want, you will not actually get independence. You have actually entered the tiger's domain and you simply want to ride the tiger. But the tiger will actually end up eating you if you don't rethink what self-rule actually means.
What did Gandhi know about the working conditions of industrial workers in Britain? And what did that say to him about the level of civilization that Britain actually could lay claim to?
So Gandhi was somewhat familiar. I mean, he was in London as a law student, the University College London, I think. And so he had lived in London for some time and he had seen, this was 19th century London, so it's, you know, pretty grim. And so he's seen some the working conditions of and factory life there, and he's read stuff about this. And his worry is that the motivations that have been guiding the British have lost touch with this definition of civilization that I mentioned earlier that he gave, which is premised on duties. Rather than thinking about their duties to each other, the British have made rational calculation the mechanism by which they evaluate their own progress. And so, drawing on a number of British thinkers, most prominently Ruskin, whose book Unto This Last Gandhi translated as Sarvodaya, Progress for All, drawing on thinkers like Ruskin.
John Ruskin.
Gandhi was clear that what should motivate us are social affections, our desire to do good to each other. And because the British have lost sight of that, very far from being the most civilized nation on the earth, they are in fact the least civilized.
Yeah, and you just made reference to a point that you really emphasize in this chapter in the volume Constructing the Pluriverse, and that is that reason or empiricism wasn't everything for Gandhi. So was Gandhi actually denouncing reason, or was he saying that it must be supplemented by things such as what you were saying, the affective attachments, the emotional attachments, the spiritual side of human existence?
Well, he does think that they need to be supplemented. He is not against empiricism. He's not against rationalism. But he thinks that these alone are insufficient for effecting the kind of moral and political change needed to liberate us from the tiger's domain. So Gandhi is very much invested in verifying the results of what he called his experiments with truth. That's not to say that he was experimenting with lying, but his experiments with his ability to capture the multifacetedness of capital T truth. So that involved a certain degree of observation, attentiveness to how we lived our lives and the consequences of our actions. But underlying that, however, was a spiritual belief. And the spiritual belief, as I mentioned earlier, was that we are all part of one human family. And so Gandhi's epistemology is a combination of these two things, of a very fine-grained, at times obsessive concern with empirical facts, but supplemented by the spiritual faith that if done well, the results that we will arrive at are ultimately results that will confirm that we are all part of one family.
And by epistemology, you mean kind of his understanding of the nature of knowledge?
Yes. I mean, so epistemology, you know, how do we know what we know? So Gandhi's epistemology is concerned with figuring out, well, I have these spiritual beliefs. I believe something is good or bad. How do I know it? Gandhi says, I know it because I'm going to try and implement it in my own life and see what the consequences of that are.
Manu Samnotra, Assistant Professor of Political Theory at the University of South Florida. And we are talking about an article, a chapter about Gandhi's thought that he contributed to a volume. It's called Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Manu. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Manu Samnotra joins me. He teaches political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. He is currently writing a book about Hannah Arendt and the political uses of shame, and he has contributed an article about Gandhi's thought. This is what we are discussing today, an article that appears in the new volume Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge. It's edited by Bernd Reiter. So your emphasis on Gandhi's interest in experimentation really comes out in this chapter in this book. In fact, the title of Gandhi's autobiography is The Story of My Experiments with Truth, not my conclusions regarding truth or, you know, or what I have set in stone in relation to truth. But of course, you know, a lot of political thinkers, political parties, political groupings, they have certain principles and ideas that they consider axiomatic. What would Gandhi think about that? Would he ever consider something to be so self-evident that one should simply accept it by virtue of having a political stance, being part of a political party, belonging to a certain kind of grouping?
Well, I mean, so if there's one group that Gandhi would certainly count himself as part of without any question regarding his allegiance to it, that would be truth. So, you know, I think I mentioned earlier he called himself a votary of truth. The problem at some level, however, being a votary of truth is that, and it sort of goes back to the word satyagraha, if you are a votary of truth, which in the context of satyagraha means a firm grasping of truth, what is to prevent you, despite your pretensions to goodwill, from insisting on your truth and mistaking your truth for the larger truth, and similarly your political opponent from doing the same? And so this is a danger. This ideological entrenchment is a danger in all kinds of politics. And so therefore Gandhi, at the sort of abstract level, is very much committed to truth, but he understands that that truth is only accessible through dialogic engagement with others and through the practice of satyagraha, which in turn depends upon loosening or breaking the circuit of our desires through nonviolence, which in turn is dependent on learning ways in which we are already embedded in systems of violence and learning to control that, which involves self-rule. And so to answer your question whether Gandhi would ever take any political position as self-evident, I mean, sure, there are some, like, you know, that nonviolence is good, that following the truth is important, showing love and compassion towards your political opponent are necessary. But as a result, he also ends up with certain kinds of positions that his political colleagues often found baffling. So at several points, or at least at one very important point in the Indian independence struggle, there is an incident in a village where some villagers basically who have been, for the lack of a better word, oppressed by the British representatives there, take the law into their own hands and kill some Indian policemen. And in this large struggle, nationwide struggle that's going on there, this is one isolated incident of violence. And Gandhi, upon hearing about this, immediately calls off the non-cooperation movement, the larger movement that was going on at the time in the Indian political scene. And all his colleagues are flabbergasted because they think independence is so close at hand. And Gandhi says, I don't want that kind of independence. I don't want an independence that is premised on violence. They say to him, but it's an isolated incident of violence. This is not something that's, you know, is true for the larger struggle that's going on, which has been largely, entirely nonviolent. But Gandhi says, no, this is not sufficient. What it tells me is that we haven't learned to control our own passions. And until we do that, we will not actually get Swaraj. We won't get self-rule of the kind that I want. And so, you know, in some ways, Gandhi's commitment to truth, commitment to nonviolence, created political outcomes that were, from, you know, a more strategic perspective, counterproductive. And yet Gandhi was, his axiomatic commitment to these things and to learning the truth of his life through experiment remained unchanged. And that's, it's at one level, infuriating, because you at least for me as a student of Indian history and as, you know, as an Indian citizen, I think to myself, oh my God, we could have had independence 15 years before, 20 years before we actually did. On another level, I'm blown away by the commitment of this man to his principles, which are good principles, the principles that I would want to, and I hope do, subscribe to.
In this chapter, you also discuss what Gandhi thought about grassroots decision-making, kind of small, village-oriented democratic decision-making versus state-level planning and decision-making. Did Gandhi favor one or the other?
Absolutely. This goes back again to his conclusions in Hind Swaraj, Indian Self-Rule, the book that I we both mentioned earlier, where the reader wants to take on the infrastructure of the modern state as the British have developed it, implemented it in India, and simply remove the people who are in charge. And as I mentioned earlier, for Gandhi, that's not a solution, or that's certainly not independence, because even that system is premised on violence. What the state does very well is that it extracts resources from one place and legitimizes it through mechanisms, large-scale mechanisms, nationwide voting, that give it the patina of democracy. For Gandhi, that is not Swaraj. And so against a large state, Gandhi favored more village-based communities. And also the small scale of these things has another advantage. Now, before I tell you what that advantage is, let me just say one other thing about many other political theorists. Plato, to take one example, Rousseau, to take another, and many others along the way and since then, have argued that if you want to have a polity, whether it's democratic or aristocratic in a good sense, like the best rule, regardless of which what the flavor is, if you want a good polity, it must be small in size. Because otherwise, if it's too large, as Plato once says, in the Republic, we're no longer working with one city, but with many cities. And that's not a solution. For Gandhi also, scale matters. Like I mentioned a moment ago, one reason is that the larger the scale, the easier it is to hide the violence that is sort of central to how the state operates. But the other part is related directly to the question of civilization that I mentioned earlier. If civilization is your ability to do your duty, our ability to understand our duty is heightened when we are able to deal with it not in an abstract sense, my duty to my nation, my duty to my race or my ethnicity, but my duty to this person or that person who I see before me. And so a village-level communities, democratic communities, would actually enable that performance of duty, which is at the core of civilization for Gandhi. And so compared to the modern state and its very large apparatus for making decisions at a grand scale, Gandhi prefers the humility of the small village-level communities.
And in preferring that and in rejecting much of the crass materialism that came with modernity, with modern civilization as he saw it in the West, did Gandhi advocate for a return to a rustic past?
So that's a question that, I'll be honest with you, I'm not fully equipped to answer definitively. Part of the reason is, I mean, there's 98 volumes of Gandhi, so the things that he says are not always consistent and not always, you know, easily remembered by students, even the best students of Gandhi, and I'm certainly nowhere near that. But on another level, I think Gandhi was also willing to learn. And so I don't want to answer the question definitively because later on in his life, Gandhi acknowledged that there are some things that are important, some things that only a state can do that local village-level communities cannot. So just to give you an example, and lately this person has gained a lot of prominence amongst political theorists dealing with Indian political thought, and that is the great constitutionalist B.R. Ambedkar. So B.R. Ambedkar was himself from the untouchable castes. He was the most prominent leader of the untouchable castes and was in constant engagement with Gandhi on the question of caste. So remember, if Swaraj is about self-rule, it is not only about ascetic control over our desires, it's also about internal reform. The independent struggle is not just about what we do with regards to the British, but also about what we do with regard to our own practices. And so Gandhi, earlier on in his life, not very early, but somewhere after he comes to India, he believes that untouchability is a sin. He believes that one should not practice it. In fact, there's an earthquake in the state of Bihar where lots of people die, and Gandhi says, much to the dismay of his colleagues, including Tagore, he says the earthquake occurred because Indians still practice untouchability. But what does one do about removing untouchability beyond simply saying that it is bad? At the village level communities that I mentioned earlier that Gandhi was fond of, those practices were very deeply entrenched. And so over time, he recognizes that in some cases, the state is important. A body that will guarantee the rights of the people who are deemed untouchable and abolish untouchability, that is a necessary part of the vision of Swaraj that he imagines. But Gandhi doesn't say very much about that. And for his part, the moment independence happens, and most readers of that moment in Indian history agree, Gandhi is basically sidelined. Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, almost chuckles at the strange notions Gandhiji has, and sort of insists on building a more secular industrial state in place of the vision that Gandhi himself advocated.
You write that Gandhi thought that satyagraha, this civil disobedience, although as you've mentioned, its meaning of it is much more complex and nuanced, that satyagraha could be practiced by Jews against the Nazis. So here we're talking about the wider applicability, the universality of Gandhi's strategy, at least in his own mind. Did people agree with Gandhi about the applicability, let's say in the case of the Holocaust or what led up to the Holocaust?
So that's actually a very complicated question regarding what Gandhi thought about the Holocaust or how to fight the Holocaust. The fact that it happened is abominable, and there's no question that Gandhi thought this way. The question, however, was posed to him in the late 30s, before the implementation of the Final Solution, which, of course, most people did not know about, including, in fact, Hannah Arendt. Most people did not learn about it, the full scale of what had happened, until after the war was over. So sitting in India, Gandhi has obviously no understanding of what's really going on. But at this point, the Nazis are expelling Jews, seizing their property. I think Kristallnacht happens as well during this time. And so someone asks Gandhi, well, what do you think Jews should do? And he says they should practice satyagraha. If they truly went out on the streets and were humble and meek and showed that they loved the Nazis, they would convert the hearts of the Nazis. The Jewish philosopher, the great Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, who was quite fond of Gandhi, wrote to him, and I quote, satyagraha is testimony. Testimony without acknowledgement is martyrdom. So to quote Hannah Arendt again, what Arendt says about the Nazis is that what they wanted most to do is to push into what she calls, quote, holes of oblivion, any scenes of resistance. They wanted to cut away from human memory altogether any sense of hope, any sense of an alternative to what they had implemented. And so if what Buber says is true and what Arendt diagnoses about the Nazis after the war is true, then what Gandhi advocated would not have worked. And what it suggests is that for satyagraha to work, it requires as a precondition the commitment to the rule of law, if not the rule of truth, as it were, the rule of law by the people we are opposing. And so the British were quite good targets of this, targets or subjects for implementing or experimenting with satyagraha, because they believed in the rule of law, or at least certainly wanted to maintain the veneer of it. The Nazis had no such compunctions about doing away with such appearances, at least as far as their Jewish populations were concerned. And so after the whole horror of everything is revealed, or at least certainly in the midst of the Second World War, someone asks Gandhi again, well, what do you think about this? Do you think your system would have worked? Jews would have been mercilessly killed by the Nazis. And Gandhi, and this is a difficult thing to wrestle with, but Gandhi says, yeah, that may have happened, but you may have actually also succeeded in converting people. We do not know. In any case, how many more people did in fact die in the war? Could those deaths have been avoided? So it's a very weird kind of accounting that he's engaging in. He's saying, it seems to me on my interpretation of it, that if Satyagraha had been implemented, people would have died, but not as many people would have died as did in the actual conflagration that took place during the Second World War. If that is what he's saying, then I personally am not very sympathetic to his calculus. On the other hand, he's throwing out a moral challenge to us, and he's saying, in effect, you can't expect your policies will fail unless you actually try them. Your strategies will fail unless you actually try them. And there's always space for trying to convert people's hearts. You have to believe that. That's his spiritual belief, and that people can be turned, can be convinced of the larger moral truth that we are all part of one human family.
So we've been talking about a lot this hour about political goals, about self-control, about, you know, ways of thinking about interconnectedness and ways of perhaps, in Gandhi's case, certainly disciplining one's body in the form of ascetic practices. So where did and how did Gandhi draw the balance between the effort to pursue political goals like emancipation and the effort to craft a better self, craft a better person? How important was one to the other in his eyes?
I think it is absolutely crucial to Gandhi's political practice that developing a better self, practicing self-control, understanding how our desires shape the way we perceive reality, the ends to which we are willing to devote ourselves, it's deeply important that attentiveness to these things be a part of any political program. Because if we do not pay attention to what it is we want and how it is that we came to want what we want, if we do not, to use that Socratic injunction, know ourselves, then we are trapped in cycles of violence that have been set in place long before us and will continue long after us. And so it is deeply important for Gandhi to practice an ethic of self-care in order to develop a self capable of entering the political realm. The self that thus enters the political realm, that is properly disciplined in its desires and in its wants, is better prepared to apprehend political reality, is better prepared to apprehend the structures of violence that make agency possible, and more importantly, from Gandhi's perspective, is able to turn the other person, convince the other person that, look, I'm not in this because I want something that's material that I will have at your expense. I'm here because I want for both of us to be better human beings, to be better in our ability to apprehend truth. And I can show you my love, Gandhi was saying to his opponent, by showing you that I do not care for myself, that I'm willing to, in fact, sacrifice myself. So Gandhi undertakes a few times in his career in India, he undertakes hunger strikes to atone for what he feels is the wrong that has been done in his name or in the interests of Indian politics to the opponent. And in this moment, Gandhi is saying, I'm so unconcerned with my well-being because I've disciplined my sense of well-being so well that my sacrifice for you is possible in the first place, is possible for me to do. But second, is meant to communicate to you that you are, in your soul, more important to me than something that you possess. And in the case of the British, your ability to rule India is not as important to me as my concern for your soul and for the soul of modern civilization, which is lost at the altar of expediency and at the altar of greed.
Manu Samnotra is his name. He teaches political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. And in the new volume, Constructing the Pluriverse, The Geopolitics of Knowledge, you will find a fascinating article, a chapter written by Manu about Gandhi's thought. It's called Experimenting with Freedom. That's what we've been talking about this hour. Constructing the Pluriverse is edited by Bernd Reiter, who is also, like Manu, a professor at the University of South Florida. It's published by Duke University Press. And again, you may want to look in the hopefully not too far future for a book by Manu about Hannah Arendt and the political uses of shame. Manu, thanks so much for your work and for this enlightening chapter and for joining us today.
Thank you so much, C.S. It was a pleasure being with you.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Hey. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.